allow her to talk to us about this called Collaborative Africa Budget Reform Meeting. So that in 30 minutes, she will forget about it. The non-negotiating money is still there.
And the language is the sister languages of Kabi and all three versions of the Afrikaans. And then we have legal opinions from the state law advisor and the Department of Foreign Affairs. And we also issued, and we have extra copies if members can receive them, some of the previous publications that were issued by Kabi in its previous work program since 2004. And even though you indicated, Chairperson, that you'll adopt the agreement and forget about it, I hope you don't literally mean that. I hope you didn't forget about it for today, because for us it's certainly a very important initiative in terms on the continent and in terms of the work that we are doing on public finance management as well. So without further ado, I'd like to tell you just to brief members on the history and objectives of CABIN. Give you an idea of the number of African countries that are participating in this important initiative, and reflect on some of the regional and international collaboration that we participated in today. I'll talk about the objectives of the legal status, why do we want to be a legal body, and why it's important for us to have that status. Reflect on some of the content of the agreement that we came here today for ratification, and South Africa's important function in terms of hosting the Secretariat of CABIN. Now, CABIN is a professional network of senior budget officials, or SBOs for short, in ministries of finance and planning from across Africa. So it's a pan-African organization, and it was formed in 2004 under the stewardship of South Africa, Mozambique, and Uganda, during an inaugural meeting in Pretoria, or workshop in Pretoria, which recognized the importance of sound public financial management and accountability. Now, I'm sure members will agree with me that many critical lessons have been learned on public finance management reforms, but these were mostly documented and discussed by external proponents of reform, rather than those who are core to reform. And I think this is where CABIN is hoping to make a difference and provide a different kind of structure in for African SBOs to engage in. Our experience has also highlighted the critical importance of country-owned, led, and managed initiatives that are tailored to local circumstances. And if we have some time to brief the committee later, we can reflect on some of the programs that have been run in the past, some of the annual seminars that have resulted in the publications that I thought of. The initiative is uniquely African-owned and led, and the membership is only open to African countries. And the key objectives are to develop approaches, procedures, and practices for managing of public finance systems. Our experience has also highlighted that it's important to have peer learning, training, and research in public finance management. And to this extent, CABIN hosted a study workshop and co-hosted by the World Bank in June last year, where we had experts from the National Treasury of South Africa engaging with their counterparts from other African countries. And the value of that kind of initiative was rated the best of all the initiatives, of all the activities of CABIN today. And finally, CABIN is modeled on the OECD SBO network, and it provides for a common voice in international debate. Just to reflect on some of the regional and international collaboration initiatives, CABIN has been identified by the G8, the Group of Eight Countries, as a key vehicle for implementation for good financial governance action plan in Africa. The G20 in September last year, jointly with the National Treasury and CABIN, co-hosted an African policy seminar on the fiscal elements of growth and development. And that was attended by very senior SBOs in Africa, but also from other countries who participated in the G20. I alluded to the joint CADRI and World Bank Institute training program on budget management and public financial accountability in June last year. This was followed by this country study tour of the National Treasury. Then currently, CADRI is conducting, together with the OECD, is conducting a survey on budget practices and procedures in Africa, which tries to examine the degree of accountability, transparency, and sound financial management across African countries. And the African Development Bank intends to publish these results of the survey once it's been concluded later this year. Other regional collaboration initiatives include the participation of the UN Economic Commission for Africa, who co-hosted the third seminar in Addis Ababa, and NEPAD secretariat and members are also attending events from time to time. Now, CADRI and Strategic Partnership with Africa, the SPA, has commissioned a study on putting aid on budgets in 10 African countries. Members will appreciate that in many African countries, that external donor funding makes up a significant part of their revenue sources, and this study is intended to ensure that there's proper accountability and transparency of donor funding, and that it gets included in the budget process and forms part of accountability. And for the future, CADRI is in discussion with the European Parliamentarian for Africa, AWEPA, to design a program focusing on the interface between ministries of finance and parliamentarians on oversight of overseas development assistance. And I would imagine that that would be a particular relevant or significant to this committee, and we would certainly want to keep you updated as we go from forward. Chairperson, when we first started off, I mentioned the initiative was started by the three countries, South Africa, Mozambique, and Uganda. And since 2004, the membership has grown to 29 countries, which you can see is spread across Africa. Now, in some of the fragile African countries, fragile African states, and in Northern Africa, you see our membership hasn't expanded that much. But as the network gains recognition, and as we're making input at various international and regional bodies, we are able to spread the good word, and hoping that we will get all African members to join them voluntarily once they recognize the benefits of being part of this important initiative. Now, why do we want to become a legal body? When CADRI was first established as a network in 2004, a draft memorandum of understanding between the existing country was finalized, and this legal agreement is based on the content of the draft memorandum of understanding, which outlines the structure of the network. It enables CADRI to be financially and legally independent from any national government and other regional bodies. For the Committee's understanding, perhaps I should note that currently the Secretariat of CADRI is established and operational within the National Treasury. So informally, they have been operating. There are only three members at the moment, with the part-time assistant of the National Treasury Chief Director, Mr. Neil Cole, as the interim Executive Secretary of CADRI, and two internationally funded colleagues as the members of the Secretariat. So the legal agreement will allow for the Secretariat to continue and for CADRI to be financially and legally independent from the South African National Treasury or any of the other African countries. The legal agreement will also support the funding arrangement, which will allow CADRI to receive membership fees and donor funding to support its activities. And it will also enable formal engagement and cooperation with other regional and international bodies. The Legal agreements allow for the establishment of cavalry, as I mentioned, the autonomy and legal status, and it recognizes the objectives and functions of cavalry, which are spelled out in the legal agreement. As I mentioned, the membership is open to all African countries, but we envisage that 6 countries will establish cavalry and that other members will join cavalry through accession to the international agreement. Once these countries accede to the cavalry agreement, or in order to accede to the cavalry agreement, the proposal will be presented at the General Assembly meeting, and once it's approved, it will be ratified and the instrument sent to cavalry, and then they will be allowed to accede. The seat of cavalry, in terms of Article 5 of the legal agreement, will be in South Africa, and then it also identifies the roles and functions of the 3 organs of cavalry, which are the Secretariat, which are responsible for the day-to-day activities of the network, the Management Committee, which manages cavalry and oversees the work of the Secretariat, and then the General Assembly, which meets once a year at our annual seminars and is responsible for the overall policy direction and operations of cavalry. We recognize the importance of participation of Francophone and Lusophone countries by having 3 official languages for cavalry. Members will also appreciate that this has significant financial implications, because it means that all workshops and seminars and activities of cavalry have to be conducted in all 3 languages, and we need to have translators on site, and that all documentation has to be translated in the 3 official languages. The finances and accounts will be presented in an audited financial report annually, and the rules and procedures which have been drafted and will be finalized later this year allows for proper levels of accountability, transparency, and responsibility within the structures and operations of cavalry. As I mentioned, the 6 founding members who are expected to ratify the international agreement first are Ghana, Kenya, Mali, Rwanda, Senegal, and South Africa. And members should have noticed that these are the 6 countries which signed the international legal agreement. And Kenya, in fact, has already deposited their instrument of ratification with the government of South Africa, which is currently the Eastern Executive Secretary of Cavalry. It is expected that the other members will then ratify the agreement by the end of this quarter. Now, should our plans materialize, Cavalry will be launched as an international organization during the annual meeting of the African Development Bank in May 2008. The Ministers of Finance from these founding countries mentioned above will invite the other Ministers of Finance who will be present at the meeting to join the initiative, and this event, we think, chairperson will strengthen the African government's commitment to good financial governance. Membership also entails paying membership fees based on a 3-tier nominal fee structure. Because cavalry has not been legally established as yet, we are totally dependent on donor funding, and as members will appreciate, that has particular restrictions and limitations in terms of the operations of cavalry. The membership fee structure, which was proposed and adopted by the last General Assembly in Ghana in December 2007, recognizes 3 countries. Three categories of membership fees. So the first category, which is members with GDP greater than $10 billion, South Africa and Kenya amongst the current proposed members fall into that category, and you can clearly see that the GDP distribution is. The second category of members are those with the GDP between $5 billion and $10 billion, and then the final category, and the final category will be those countries with a GDP less than $5 billion. Now, in recognition of the ability of members to pay, the General Assembly has recommended the following type of fee structure. For Category 1 members, which includes South Africa and Kenya, the annual membership fee will be $50,000. For Category 2, $25,000. As a Category 3, $15,000. If all 29 member countries contribute these amounts, it would amount to $850,000, which represents 64% of SADC's budget for the financial year 2007-8. The chairperson, I should also mention that these membership fees are minimum, and in the spirit of collegiality, members are encouraged to pay more than the minimum where they are able to do so, because as you can clearly see, these funds are not sufficient to cover the activities of SADC. The founding member countries, in other words, the six that I've mentioned earlier, their contribution which represents 16.2% of the total membership fees, and these fees will be revised every 3 years. The Secretariat's current operational cost amounts to $440,000, which would be 47% of the total membership fees. And the remaining budget, of course, will then still have to be provided by donors. In order for South Africa to participate in CABRI and for Parliament to ratify this agreement, the Minister of Finance signed the international agreement on the 7th of August last year, and Cabinet approved it on the 24th of October, subject to parliamentary ratification in terms of Section 231 of the Constitution. Our financial contribution members will only become effective in 2019, and the funds have been budgeted on the National Treasury Board. And as I mentioned earlier, the legal status is expected to be finalized between March to April of this year in order to allow for the launch of CABRI at the African Development Bank meeting. As I mentioned earlier, South Africa has the very important task of permanently hosting the CABRI Secretariat, and this decision may only be changed by the General Assembly. We will conclude a standard hosting agreement in consultation with Foreign Affairs, the South African Revenue Services, and the Department of Home Affairs. In terms of Section 5.3 of the agreement, Section 5 of the CABRI agreement, the hosting agreement has to be concluded as soon as is reasonable between CABRI and the government of South Africa, after CABRI is legally established with clear stipulations on the privileges, immunities, immigration, tax exemptions, disputes, and so forth. And we do envisage that the Secretariat of CABRI, as the activities and expand, that the Secretariat will also expand beyond its current 3 members, and that the organization will be in a position to employ a permanent executive secretary. Chairperson, South Africa, I should also mention, is making in-kind contributions to the Secretariat by hosting them at the National Treasury offices free of charge, and of course providing telephone and other administrative infrastructure. So with that in mind, Chairperson, I hope I've given you enough of a background on how important CABRI is to the National Treasury and certainly to South Africa as a participant and as the hosting country. We would like to recommend that Parliament ratifies the agreement in terms of Section 231 in all 3 official languages, and you'll have to take my word for it that it was translated and verified by the by the special advisors of Foreign Affairs and the Department of Justice, that the committee notes that South Africa's obligation to hosting CABRI subject to the agreement of the subject to the conclusion of the hosting agreement, and that the committee notes the annual financial contribution payable by South Africa for 2019. I think it's true.
So today, if I'm not an expert of this, I'll be sure to get to my time with you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Thanks for the presentation. Chair, we know your on the lifetime note. That among those who were not identified themselves with this initiative, brother leaders will understand that. Just by the way. Just don't be people who are the same.
What
will I the presentation, among others, is saying that Capri is one to enjoy financial and legal independence from the mother country. But then, the other way, they are showing some kind of deficit in their government. And therefore, to some extent, they rely on donor funds, those smaller fractions of their rights. Chair, I would have understood better if they were talking about institutional, not independent, but institutional, what do you call it? It's not independent. Autonomy, yes, then. Autonomy, as rather than legal. Yeah. Who's on about maximum of people, or to get over? Chair, especially if you are doing legal independence from the national government, I would like to have an understanding before I develop my own. Yeah. Can we notice some of the focus is to promote multilateralism among other things, including the financial services countries? Okay, I'll stop here for now. Thank you.
Yes, we know that we don't want to use this budget today. We live with a not enough
Thank you for the thought-provoking questions, members. I can see that you have studied the agreement, and I wasn't expecting an easy ride this morning. The issue on financial and legal independence, that if you allow me to, let me just give you some background. When TABI, the network, was established or formed in 2004, TABI continued to have annual activities. There's an annual seminar with a different theme, and at the end of the seminar, there would be a publication. And there was a management committee and secretariat in terms of the draft memorandum of understanding. But because South Africa was one of the founding members, the secretariat informally operated within a unit at the National Treasury. Initially, it was in the unit where I currently work, expenditure planning, and we had the chief director dedicating his time, 15% of his time and sometimes more, to the activities, and we had a secondian, an intern, if you like, an ODA fellow, who was assisting with some of the technical and administrative work. But as the network gained recognition and momentum, and the events that TABI hosted became bigger and accommodated more members, and the membership grew annually, it became important that we were able to obtain our own or our funding, that CABI was able to, instead of relying on donors exclusively, which have their conditions for funding, for example, for an annual seminar, of which the cost would be, you know, the region of about $200,000, because CABI would pay for members' flights to ensure attendance for the experts who participate in the program. There are various other administrative costs involved. The donors would typically cherry pick these kind of activities that they wanted to finance. And if we continued on that kind of trajectory, it would have meant our deficit would have been even greater. Because many of the donors, for example, don't want to fund flights. They want to fund studies or papers or, you know, documents to which they can put their name. But for funding flights and accommodation, they don't really have anything to show. So they recognize that CABI is important, but they weren't willing to fund the budget in total. And it became a problem for us in terms of our activities. The second issue is because CABI, the Secretariat, is based in South Africa, there's a little bit of a perception that this is South African owned and driven, and that's not the idea. It's a pan-African organization to which all African member countries can belong, and even those may have a permanent seat in South Africa for the Secretariat, in the same way as the African Development Bank was initially meant to be hosted in the Ivory Coast and is now in Tunis. South Africa has that kind of relationship, and it will spell out our obligations very clearly towards the organization as a country and theirs towards ours. So it's not really legal independence from national government. The government of South Africa would be a member of CABI, but we didn't want to create the impression that South Africa was a more important member than, for example, Mozambique, Uganda, Kenya, who used to be the chairperson of the management committee. So I hope that makes it so clear. In terms of the reliance on donor funding, I think I've alluded to that. When you rely on donor funding, you have to comply with donor conditions. And that has restricted our activities and our movements, and, you know, often donors have made commitments and perhaps not meet it by the time when you needed them to, and, you know, a lot depends on their willingness to fund events and activities, and there's a lot of uncertainty involved in that. And as an organization which promotes good financial management and governance, it's important that we set the tone by showing financial discipline, by having multi-year budgets, and this is something that, you know, we struggle with many of the donors because their commitments typically would be once-off in nature or for 1 year only. They're not very keen on providing an indication of the long-term funding, and that introduces a lot of uncertainty. Then the other important question about Uganda, Mozambique, and South Africa being the members who established CABI as a network but not being founding members is a very interesting point. The text of it. not quite the question. Although these were the members which established CABI, and we would very much have liked for all of them to be part of the initial members, we recognize that if we allow all members who are currently part of the network to establish CABI, because of the internal or national legal processes, it might be a very long time before CABI becomes a legal organization. In our own case, for example, we have to get cabinet approval and we have to get parliamentary ratification, and other countries have far more complicated legal processes. So to avoid, you know, the delay in establishing CABI legally, because we've been operating since 2004, we thought we would allow a minimum threshold of 6 countries to legally establish CABI. And that could have been any 6 countries. It just happened at the time when the negotiations on the legal agreement were finalized that these 6 countries that I mentioned who signed the agreement were ready to proceed and accept the tax and to table it in the legislature and parliament for approval. And in Kenya, for example, their internal processes have allowed them to ratify the agreement and deposit it. The other five countries, including South Africa, have similar processes where it will allow them to ratify the agreement by May when we intend to formally launch cabinet. Now, of course, nothing stops Uganda or Mozambique from adopting the text and ratifying the agreement before South Africa. If they can do it, you know, within the next 2 weeks and all the other five countries do it, then we might not be known as a founding member. But indications are that only these six countries which have signed the agreement are able to participate and establish cabinet legal as a founding member. Mozambique and Uganda, in fact, participated in the negotiation on the legal text. So they ensured that, you know, their interests were also considered and taken into account in finalizing the agreement, but they indicated that they would not be able to ratify the agreement by the due date that we set for establishing cabinet, and therefore they have the option of excluding the cabinet. Now, so for that purpose, it's important that we are one of the founding members. I participated in the negotiations on behalf of the country, and because we have an obligation towards hosting the secretariat, I think it's important, and you know, that's why perhaps Mr. Halani, we were a little bit persistent in getting the committee to consider this agreement, and we're very grateful for your time. And then just in terms of the regional collaboration, I've mentioned to you, you know, some of the collaboration that's happened today with the UNECA, which co-hosted the seminar in Ethiopia with the African Development Bank and so forth. Our objective is to liaise within all these structures that are currently operating. We're not trying to duplicate what other organizations are doing, and I'm sure you'll agree with me, CADRI has a unique kind of character and objective in terms of it. You know, what it seeks to achieve in public finance management for senior budget officials. And our objective is to continue our engagement and participate in other bodies where we can make a contribution on public financial management and financial governance. In the three categories of fees, I think it's quite clear where the members are coming from. If any other member were to join after CADRI was legally established, they would have to do it through accession, as I've explained, and then these would be the membership fees applicable to them, and of course they have the option of paying more if they are in a position to do so. I hope I've responded to all the questions. If not, I'm happy to clarify further.
I just want to know what the implications are for sub-national government. For example, regarding the obligation of the national chapters of CADRI towards ensuring that the same exchanges in terms of the objectives and functions take up to sub-national government.
Thank you very much. There are no specific obligations of sub-national government in terms of either fees or, you know, in terms of performing any duties. However, at the annual seminars, and members will see this, I encourage you to please look at the publications and some very interesting case studies on African countries where we draw distinctions between, for example, fiscal decentralization in South Africa versus Mali. So, you know, I'm just using that as an example. I don't think there's an actual case study either. But during these annual seminars, and once the themes have been decided, we do incorporate items of discussion that are of interest to sub-national governments. for South Africa, we've had 6 years of government, and some of the members here at this meeting from intergovernmental relations have presented at the cabinet seminar on how the South African intergovernmental system works. So it would be in terms of programs, discussions, peer learning and sharing of ideas, but there would be no specific obligation on provincial or local government in terms of cabin. But they are welcome to participate, and to the extent that the programs will accommodate, you know, issues of discussion on subnational government and even the role of parliament. Of course, those role players from the various countries will be involved.
The last one from Mr. Chief, I think that the whole idea is to establish good government amongst the member countries. Now, my colleague said we have gone through the documents. Maybe I was not going to tell you. What I see here is the structure. I'm not very sure as to once the founding members are members, is there a mechanism like in the African review, in the African peer review mechanism, members have got to go an extra mile to ensure that the member countries do what you call subscribe, both in letter and practically in the what you call it, in the terms of what you call. Now here, is it just sufficient to be a member? Or how do you ensure that these member countries really adhere to the principles of the letter of the Constitution?
I think that's a very important question that the members just asked. CABI doesn't have the autonomy to enforce certain practices, but through our negotiations, discussions, and annual seminars and events, we hope that others will see the benefit in good governance. For example, South Africa was, and members might be aware of this, was rated 6 amongst 29 countries on its transparency of budget documentation. Now, you know, as with any kind of initiative, across the world, it was different countries, the US, UK, New Zealand, and in some instances, we were even rated above them. So when we go to these forums and we present our budget documentation and demonstrate to members why we were rated 6 amongst the number of countries surveyed, is an incentive of them. It encourages kind of competition, wanting to emulate and wanting to share the benefits. And of course, with transparency and good governance come all sorts of other benefits. You can borrow money cheaper, you have more recognition internationally, and, you know, we're hoping to encourage that kind of sound governance through negotiations, dialogues, and peer review and learning. So CABI wouldn't be able to enforce it and say we're going to disallow you from participating in events, but through the discussions we're hoping that others will see the benefit and follow suit. And in our experience, it has been very much the case. As I said, it's been country-led, owned and managed, and everybody sees the benefit of doing it in the same way as the peers, and we can share the lessons learned amongst each other, and they're able to comply much sooner.
And of course, this interaction is where we have customs, which is one of the very few steps, which enables to ensure that some of the applicants in the final answer. There is a report that shows that as a result of collaboration between this country and for the first time we look at the entire system. We run our staff units to collect homeless in some of the counties. And that is really things that many of the agencies that we also commission our staff of the country. These kinds of initiatives are assisting our African countries to grow. I do want to add numbers to I think my point to be something to element of they operate from an old building since 1909. Committees in this there are no committees in the Parliament of India. There are three clusters of committees in that country. There are no set countries in the case of committees. When that country was liberated in 1962, now the kind of initiative there of having a committee. Now, can I then raise this question? Who is opposed?
I thought you were going to be like the Minister of Finance, Chief, the Finance is in which the Cabinet.
That is interesting. You cannot believe the Cabinet is so big, but that is more expensive. You also have just to me. There are many big challenges in that country. But let's not believe that for now. But I was saying this initiative is really going to assist our African countries and the other of us. Madam, I want you to leave your position whilst you are leaving. Mr. Poole in the Cameron sits here. Mr. Brown just sat on the other chair. And Mr. Herrera on my right here. Now,
cool chairman, the unseated
Thank you
very much for your time, sir. Pastor, if I may just add, it made me want to know anything more about CABI. I know this briefing was quite rushed, but I appreciate your time. There's a website in our publication, www.africa-sbo.org, where you can find more information. Thank you.
We're moving from the continent to the national. What they are moving up and down. Kamga Mohammed, Dao and Margo, I've got three seats for you here as the second. Kamga! Kamga here. No, you can't be. Dao and Margo, right here. Sister Nera. Thank you, my lord. Now, whilst you are coming over, Mr. Herrera, I want to raise something for you. Come on over. Because we want an answer to this question. I'm taking advantage of the fact that you are here today. The Whip of Committee phoned me over the weekend. He was looking at the regulation. The federal regulation for department, state management, constitutional institutions, etc. Internal control and corporate management, section 27. Okay. Then talking about what is promised. The chairperson of the committee must be independent, the manager of the status of the congregation, have the requisite business, financial and leadership skills, and may not be chairperson of the company of public, or exerting local skills and executive function in that public entity.
Can you try to organize someone to come and fix that thing first?
This
is only just proof of
Oh, okay, then you are your sister. So what are you saying,
Madam Cabrera here?
And Mr. Fulula, we had a discussion with the during the annual report of the FFC. Now, one of the members of the commission is a chairperson of the audit committee. We have a right to start ourselves, Mr. Kafka. Now, they have to say to us, no, he is not in the employed plan of the FFC. But what we're saying is that he is a member of the committee. And so, in view therefore of this session, we still want more elaboration because we still are not convinced that he is an independent, etc. If he is knowledgeable, etc., in terms of the field, but we think he's still in part of the entity, if you like. It is something that really worries us. Certainly, we wanted to check what this section means and this clause means. And then take it from there because we still want you to get some legal advice, but then now that our legal advisor is here, we wanted to abuse the opportunity.
And I think the question has come up before in terms of the meaning of independence. How is it guided in a number of other institutions is to allow people. Even if they are members of the accounting authority to participate in audit committees, as long as they are not a chairperson or an employment in an executive function. I think it is becoming quite a problem, and I would like the opportunity to go back to it, because we have done a legal opinion on it, and I maybe might be able to support that all for you and submit it to the committee.
Thank you, madam. On that note, okay. I also think that practically if they happen to have him for now and say the term of office is going to expire soon, I think that it might just be within the standard mandate of the committee to just encourage the FFC to look elsewhere for people, especially to care the committee. In a way, that one is not even if you just, regardless of what the strict interpretation of the law may say, that's something that I think would be in order to just say to the FFC, look, you have had him for whatever period, but in our view, it might be better for you to just find another person who is completely dissociated with the FFC in all manner of capacities, because there are too many people who probably can play that role. Rather than have someone around whom they are questioning in terms of the same.
In fact, our substitution was also prompted by the fact that because we even thought the audit committee was not very much useful. So part of the problem there is that in terms of the FFC law, we're not supposed to go into other class. And in the last year, they in fact overspent. And so our biggest worry was in the past few years, we might have been able to keep this thing up. And in the best of the fact that he is part of the commission, therefore, there was negligence and complaints and so on and so on. So there's just some of the problem that really worried us. But fundamentally, the fact that also he is a member of the commission really did worry us. But then let's talk then about
it would seem that for this. Some of the colleagues are lost about that is talking about.
So you see, this shouldn't be lost because this is a matter that we discussed during the FFC annual report. Okay? So we've been doing some little work and Mr. Sokoni over the last weekend was reading through the treasury regulation because remember we were always saying that the chairperson of the audit committee is a member of the commission. So it's a matter that we've been working on for some time, and we do want to resolve it. Because if you remember, Daniel, when you said that FFC must go back, you came back with the same old answer, that this person
he is not in the employ, even though he is a commission. But still, ourselves are still not satisfied with the answer. And so it's a matter that we must, I think, Mr. Fugler and I, but of course, the opinion that that's going to get is going to be issued. So that we must then engage brutally. We still remember that we have also not adopted the annual report of the FSC, pending those things that we needed to deal with. So for clearly, it's a matter that we must prioritize this report.
Okay, first I can remember that issue was raised previously with the FSC. And then they had a discussion on their commission.
Yeah.
And as that commission, their resolution was that he is the independent. They see them as an independent, although they get we get it. But they still see them as independent because it's not on the management. And that is why they make the resolution that they will he can contribute in regard to that, and that's where he would disagree with them in regarding of the act of the entertainment not be a part of the organization and to have an influence on the financial standing of the
So we come back to that. Can we then allow Mr. Fulia again, as we were saying, and welcome to this little committee that's really as a very special welcome to our own colleagues from the province, Gauteng, as the presenter at the 15th. And it's very useful, precisely because I think this discussion of the business region is a very, very critical discussion. And in tomorrow's workshop, we intend to really to empower us to be at one when we're dealing with the issues of the indigenous revenue. And so it's a that critical moment of our time when especially the finance committee must be talking to each other about money allocated to the policy. So we'll pick up some things, colleagues, which I think we will just share with you tomorrow. In respect of the budget, in the context of the African research, in the context of the science, some of the things that we see are the best practices in provinces. We will talk about these things tomorrow so that we do want to help members and the society to be much more vigilant in dealing with these matters in the provinces. I know there would be some tensions here and there, but I think that is fair in terms of the new government. Mr. Fugler.
Honorable Chair and other members, we also have with us two colleagues, Ms. Cindy Mutiani, who is in our legal justice section, with Mr. Jonathan Patrick, who is the director in our local government policy section. I with your permission, Chair, I'm gonna request Mr. Brown to lead the presentation. I'll just talk to one challenge which I anticipate the committee to probably be uncomfortable with, but perhaps one would want to preempt the unhappiness with the following qualification. And this change relates to the fact that in the current version of the deal, we have taken out, following discussions with housing, the clauses that relate to accreditation. Now, just 2 points on that. The first point is that there is, as the members would know, a provision in the Housing Act of 1997 which provides for accreditation. The introduction of certain provisions in the bill or in the Division of Revenue Act were intended to really sort of clarify what accreditation is and what can be the steps followed in it, but also to just infuse a sense of urgency to ensure that process got accelerated.
in 2 or 3 years, very little progress has happened in that regard, as members would know. But some work has happened. Some work has taken place in respect to developing a framework for accreditation, but also to award some accreditation, albeit on a limited basis, level one type. What we do have, though, which is some sense of comfort that we have been able to agree with House, which does take the process a step forward, is that in the clauses that relate to the preparation for following for future years in this bill, we have been able to agree to insert provisions that require that the provincial department of housing must work with municipalities, especially those that are targeted for accreditation in future, and agree a set of projects in each municipality, a housing project, and indicative allocation for the financial year 2009-10 to 2011-12. Now we hope that once, if that can be implemented, then it does immediately deal with one of the major problems in respect of accreditation, that accreditation sought to deal with, which is to say to municipality, you will be getting so much money for housing over the next couple of years, which then allows the municipality to identify land for housing development, zone it appropriately, lay out the infrastructure that will then prepare for housing. But in addition to that, what we also have now are provisions to the effect that where between municipalities and the provincial department of housing they are not able to arrive at this, there can be some mediation by national government, even up to a point where these allocations should be determined nationally. We think that that would sort of go some way to laying a basis for faster accreditation in future years.
Thank you, Mr. President. I had to say refer to this committee as a local committee. I just want to say it's not really a local committee, it's quite an important committee in the division of the soil and all other activities that relate to sub-national government. I'm also pleased to announce that actually we've improved quite a bit our consultation processes during this year. I doubted that we will have any kind of department coming here and disagreeing with what is actually contained in the bullet. These are hopeful. I'll just run through quickly the presentation. The outline of the presentation it lays out basically the bill, its content. It looks at the changes to the 2007 Division of Revenue Act. Then we zoom a bit into the fiscal framework, how the cake has been sliced up and what is owed to the funding. And then we look at the proposals made by the SSP and how government is actually responding to some of that. And then a little bit of detail provided on provincial and local government allocation there. Now some of the changes are technical, just to improve the readability of the bill and to better align some of the sections. If the members can recall, we had a scenario where municipalities that received allocations of less than, I think it was 2 million at the time, some of the allocations had to via to certain category C municipalities. Specifically, our low capacity municipalities. Now, all of those provisions have been taken out there. And as the committee would like to see, we've actually even proposed to increase the share of money that's actually going to some of these municipalities quite substantially over the NCF. On accreditation, the NUCA has touched basically on that. Then there's an issue around some of the public entities that are actually implementing some of the programs. And here, if you think about housing, you think about, for example, Kibbutz homes, for example, and for example that. And what we are doing now in this course is actually to extend the reporting requirements to those particular kinds of entities who are implementing some of the programs here of provinces. Yeah? On the municipal infrastructure grant there, what we've seen is we've invested quite large amounts of money on municipal infrastructure over the years. But when we start to talk about what the impact of those particular investments were, you know, the picture becomes quite a bit of sketchy. And what we are now expecting municipalities to do is to report, in addition to financial performance, to actually start to say what that money is actually being buying there. So they need to then report now regularly on non-financial performance there. But then also, what we will be expecting is that the Transporting National Department also report basically monthly to the National Treasury on the implementation of that grant. Yeah. Then on 2010 FIFA World Cup stadium development grant, some of the contracts of the stadium currently under construction are a bit open-ended here and there. And all that this clause is saying is to say whatever contracts are still open in the due needs to be finalized not later than the 1st of June this year. Okay. Then on provincial treasuries, basically the information that must be published as part of the budget document is extended basically to housing allocations to municipalities, infrastructure, but on that. But what we are also expecting is all transfers that are made to schools must also now be gazetted. Now, what we have basically is the National Department of Education is gazetting the funds that go to most schools, for example. Now, what is expected now is that provinces and provincial treasuries in particular gazette all allocations and all transfers that would be made basically to schools directly there. Then, it is also expected from provincial treasuries to publish the full budget of provincial hospitals. We have provided the template basically to them, and that template will be used so that each hospital's budget is basically known. The reason why we included the hospital one is also to foster issues around transparency, better planning there, because sometimes what we have picked up was the provincial hospital budgets in many cases were not consistent over the years. So in 1 year you'll have an allocation that is probably lower than in the previous year. So it is really just to get a sense of what's happening with those particular budgets of hospitals there. So we're expecting really over 400 hospital budgets to be published over the 9 provinces there. An important in-person year is the issue around what provinces do and their relationship within the IDPs of municipalities. And I think the chair for the past couple of years is talking about the parachuting of infrastructure basically in certain areas. And now what this case seems to achieve is that the infrastructure plans of provinces must basically now be aligned to municipal IDPs as well, as is now a requirement there. Then the copying of allocations, what we do here is basically the Treasury may authorize an intervening transferring national officer to spend an allocation on behalf of a province. If a province is not performing, when the allocation is stopped, then the national transferring officer can basically then intervene by spending that allocation on behalf of the province. Now that, I think, would be subject to Section 100 of the Constitution in any case. Then, preparation for the next financial year. What Mr. Fuzela alluded to here was the issue around preparing allocations now for housing over the next 3 years. I think what we have seen, and I think the FSC in past recommendations also alluded to the misalignment that exists between municipal infrastructure and housing delivery, and what we're trying to do with the clause is actually to bring that alignment quite closer so that the municipality is now fully aware of the housing development that will actually take place within its jurisdiction. But at the same time, when it does its own planning, that it aligns its planning basically what would happen with integrated housing and human settlement, basically there. Then the bill itself, I'll just run through basically how the bill is structured. Then it has got 49 clauses, 7 schedules, and that 7 schedules shows how the funds are divided between the 3 spheres and how it is divided within the sphere as well. Then there's a memo room of the bill. Yeah. Then we've got what is known as our explanatory attachment, what is important, W1, is actually the old NSE that fully explains all of the allocations, basically there. Then appendix W2 and W3 provides all the frameworks for all conditional grants, that's provincial and local. W4 to W8 provides all local government allocations by municipalities for both municipal and the national finances. So every transfer basically that goes to a municipality is contained basically in the bill. The government schedule 1 shows the division between the 3 spheres of government. Schedule 2 shows the equitable share that goes to provinces. Schedule 3, the local government equitable share that goes to the 283 municipalities. And Schedule 4 shows all the other transfers that go to provinces and municipalities that are supplementing programs funded from own revenue. And what happens in Schedule 4, around the reporting requirements are such a nature that reporting is done on the program and not necessarily only on the grant basically itself there. Schedule 5 are specific corporate allocations that go to provinces, and 6 are specific corporate allocations that go to municipalities, and Schedule 7 are all the in-kind transfers basically to municipalities. Now the budget review, chapter 7 and 8, basically summarizes the national, provincial and local government priorities and the funding that underpins those priorities. And NHA W1 of the bill that is contained in the bill there provides greater detail on all the funds, how they are divided and there. Now the NHA itself has got 5 parts. Part 1 deals with the division of revenue between the 3 spheres and how that division takes into account section 214-280J of the Constitution. Part 2 responds to the government's response to the FSC proposals, and Part 3 deals with allocation that goes to provinces. Part 4 deals with allocation that goes to local government. And Part 5 concludes with some of the issues that are ongoing of nature, the work that still must be done on provincial and local government there. Then the appendices W2 and 3 are the grant frameworks basically for municipalities in that and provinces. It provides the purpose of the grant, the measurable output conditions, the allocation criteria, past performance of the grant, planning for 2019, responsibilities of national departments, grant review process for health grants, and transferring department quarterly report. What we have included for the housing one is a specific section that requires specific responsibility for Tbilisi Shalom in terms of reporting requirements that's required for Tbilisi Shalom for the housing one. Okay. Then W4-8, local government allocations for municipalities, basically all of that is there. Per municipal and national financial year, and it provides quite a bit of the details of the breakdown of everything, basically all the formula, part of the equitable set is divided by the formula, part of the equitable set is divided by RG there, and for transfer recommendation there. Now, on the fiscal framework, before we divided the text, basically we took into account the proposals put forward, the recommendations made by the FSC there. These were thoroughly discussed throughout the year. Budget Council considered the provincial proposals. This time around, except for a little bit of what happened with the World Cup, there are no major kind of proposals that are made to local government, but these were highlighted at the budget forum there. And all spheres basically interacted and deliberated on the proposals, and what we see here is basically a collaborative kind of government response to these proposals. Now, the ones that have got direct bearing on the 2008 and 9 division of revenue, the main one really was the impact of the 2010 FIFA World Cup. That the funding that is put aside there, or rather, how we finance the entire World Cup situation shouldn't basically adversely impact Section 214 to 80J of the Constitution. We basically agree with the FSC that whatever we will do, we will make sure that that section is not really jeopardized. Incidentally, of the 115.6 billion that we actually adding to the structural framework, roughly about, I think, 3.2 billion goes basically to the World Cup. So proportionally, if you look at it, really nothing that much as a percentage is going for that. Then, on the school nutrition program itself, what the FSC is really proposing is that the overall administration of the school nutrition program really be improved. The way this phrase is on its way of extending it to secondary schools, that actually be improved. And what government is really saying, basically, is we agree that the overall administration of the program needs to be improved. Incidentally, I think this year we're even adding about 1.8 billion, I think, to the program, so that we really increase its coverage, basically, because what the FSC is also saying is that a part of the funds needs to be, all the schools that are classified as mostly schools, for example, must benefit basically from the program. So the additional funds will ensure that the coverage is improved, and at the same time that the quality of the meals is basically improved, and to make sure that the number of days covered is really covered universal across all provinces. Now, government view here is we need to fix it at the primary level before we can really think of expanding it to secondary school. The next one, which is quite an important one, is the issue around the relationship between school infrastructure investment and education outcome. In the study that the FSC has conducted, basically, there is quite a bit of a correlation. If you improve the infrastructure in schools, it will contribute to education outcomes. Government is, over the next 3 years, going to invest about 2.7 billion, adding, basically, to improve school infrastructure. So over the next 3 years, government will spend roughly about 17.8 billion over the next 3 years. What is quite a bit of a concern for government is the fact that at the provincial level, we see little is done in terms of maintenance of schools. So we're building new classrooms all the time, but we fail to maintain those ones, and it's something that we are looking into basically as well. And then on learner support material, what the FSC is saying, you know, when we want to assess how much government is really spending on learner support material, the budget structure itself sometimes don't give you that kind of information. But how the budget is structured, do we have a separate budget line basically for learner support material? Whether it is invested in that way is something else. But what is a bit of a deficit in education is because large transfers are also made to schools. And it's the sector, for example, is a transfer. So you don't really also get an extent what part of that portion is really used for learner support material. And it is something that we need to look at. And in terms of addressing all the challenges that are relating to multi-school policy, I think one of the major proposal that is made is that the multi-school policy must fully compensate the loss of revenue of the school, so that the school is in a position to basically function as if, you know, there wasn't any revenue loss. So there we basically agree that it is done within the normal funding norms of schools. We've got, I think it ranges between 540 and about over 700 rand basically per child. There are some provinces, one or two, that are still funding at a minimum level, and we are nudging them basically to fund at the maximum level of that. Yeah. On road and transport infrastructure, what the FSC is basically saying is there's no proper management system in place at the provincial level to really monitor what is happening with road infrastructure management. So Sometimes we may be investing, do we know, you know, whether the kinds of our investments are, and do we know whether we actually even investing in the right roles, for example. I think last year with the tabling of the IGFR, we were also talking about why the cost differential, actually even in the construction of roads, where a same stretch of road will cost $5 million per kilometer. If you extend the same road just a few kilometers further, you find that the cost probably double. So there's all of these things that actually come into play. In fact, I was listening to Morning Live this morning, and they were saying, you know, people are putting in now all these signs, we have the portals and all that. It will actually be cheaper for government to say, this area doesn't have portals. And then you have fewer billboards actually put into it. But it is a serious issue that we need to actually pay quite a bit. Yes. But seeing that Mr. Botha is talking, you know, when you talk about Limpopo, for example, Limpopo has got a large transport budget, and correct me if I'm wrong, a large road infrastructure budget. I think they spent, the entire public works budget was about 2.5 billion, and I think they spent close to 1.5 billion on road infrastructure. And you ask yourself, if you actually go into Limpopo itself, do you get a sense that this money was spent in which area it was spent? Because as soon as you branch off the N1, what happens to the rest of the road?
Let's tell you a story. We are from Limpopo only now. Right. In fact, the Department of Agriculture supported the community here. Agriculture is building access roads to the farm. Now, when you have the man, the one who comes right, tell us what you said. Roads say you are not even aware that they are roads. You know what? Because they are not supposed to do that. But what they are saying to us is that
in that very thing is a challenge in Limpopo. And you are so correct. We need to be a bit brutal in terms of monitoring this thing. Because the problem is that for us is the same thing that we're talking about of nudging. We also have to go there and nudge treasury to look at the baseline of health. Before we went there, the baseline was 24.1%. Now when we left, it's 25.9%. The baseline must be 26%. But we were saying to them, they must then continue costing, maybe could be 26 plus. Something what you're saying is just correct. And this is what we want to urge also members is our team, and to be much more vigilant about these baselines. But also finding a way of really assisting both the National Treasury and Commission, but also not the Commission Treasury and EXCO. So finally, because you know when you go to Limpopo, everybody is committed to the provincial growth and development strategy. But what they do does not reflect.
Thank you.
Also, there's agencies. In the proper, we've got the road agencies. In Eastern State, there's the local police agencies. So, you know, it's without accountability, we don't get accountable for that. We see it below.
We give them an instruction after we discuss instructions for when what is the national about those monitors.
No, we don't need a few people in the service to transport that office. Then there was an issue around how roads is funded through the equitable share. Now currently, roads is funded through the provincial infrastructure grant, and actually provinces themselves augment a lot of it. Now what we're saying to the FSC basically is they are in any case driving the review of the entire equitable share formula itself. So within that review, they need to look at how the roads essence of the funded there. Then there is an issue around using homelessness data basically in the housing formula. It is used in the housing formula, but the FSC is of the view that the collection of the data basically needs to be improved for that. These are other proposals basically where they made supplementary submissions over the years, and we've taken those basically into account. And they also currently busy with some kind of budget analysis there, and it's basically just work in progress from the side of the FSC. Now, after taking into their account the proposal that was put forward, we basically came to this particular division of revenue. So what you see there basically is the share of additional resources in W1.4. That is basically split up between the three spheres of government there. The next table basically just shows what the revised baselines are for the three spheres. The national government share basically grows from 247 billion to 324 in 2010-11. Provinces 205 to 293 in 2010 and 11, and the last chunk of that is basically an equitable share. Local government, we see quite a sharp growth in local government there. And whilst we see this growth in local government, I think we also need, as a treasury, at some point, to really get to some kind of a discussion around how do we make some of the local government less dependent on national transfer, so that we can really distinguish between the poorer ones and fund the poorer ones quite a bit optimally, but also with some kind of incentive for them to do the right thing and even generate quite a bit of revenue. Right? But we can see the share of local government is growing quite rapidly from 7.6% to 8.3%. So collectively, when we take the 2 years, they get quite a large chunk of national revenue. Then W1.5 basically shows what is Schedule 1 of the division of revenue builder. What you see in national there, what is included in the national sphere there is firstly is debt service costs is included in that one now. The contingency reserve is included in that one. And all the conditional grants are only reflected at national in this table. Whereas in the provincial and local government one, the pure equitable share for provinces, the pure equitable share for local government. Right? So the provincial fiscal framework, which is part 3 of NSW1, looks at basically all the councils that are made to provinces. Provinces get about 45.7 billion of that 115 billion. 33.2 of that goes to the equitable share and 12.5 billion goes to conditional grants. This will achieve quite a large personnel adjustment. We know the wage agreement there needs to be implemented. The inflation is quite a bit high for next year. I think it's going to be in the, or at least for this financial, for the next financial year, it will be in the order of about 7%. So there's quite that element that's covered in that adjustment for personnel. But also at the same time, is to look at specific kind of dispensations for educators, health and social workers, the health professionals and social workers. Right. Now some of the priorities, why I run through this is also to sensitize the committee that what needs to be reflected basically in provincial budgets. In education, again, it's a further extension of grade R there. It makes provision for learners with special needs. The issue around increase of education there. The committee is aware that we've got a new curriculum statement now, right up to matric. And what the fund provides for is to protect books from 10, or learning support materials rather, from grade 10 to 12 there. Then 2.7 billion, basically that is added for education infrastructure. Yeah? Now, we are aware that HIV/AIDS and TB is putting quite a bit of pressure on health budgets. Now, what we've provided for here is quite a general adjustment to the health budget so that it can stabilize the public health system there. On comprehensive HIV/AIDS, what we have there is again quite a substantial increase again to the HIV/AIDS grant. And there's a further step up for the hospital revitalization grant. I'll show it in a table, a summary of how much money goes where. And social development again, there's the issue around ECD. That's also funded there, and access to women coming into today's scheme. Further provision is made basically for roads, agriculture, and economy development, and quite an adjustment to the housing and human settlement grant. I think I need to keep that up few slides. Yeah. Now, the formula that we use, the provincial equitable share formula to divide the money, the temperature between the nine provinces. For this round, the structure of the formula remains unaffected. As I've indicated, the FSC is currently busy with a bit of work to look at the structure of the formula and how to divide the funds. So, in addition to that, we are aware of the process that's currently being driven by DPSG on the white paper of local government and provinces as well. So, whatever happens there also will inform how the sharing of the funds between the nine provinces will actually take place in future years. But for now, we've only updated the formula for the latest available data, which is the 2007 community survey, the 2007 snapshot. Survey and education, we've covered that involvement there. The 2006 general household survey and 2005 GDP by region information. Now, the committee can remember last year, because of the demarcation, we have decided not to phase in the changes because of the structural change that's actually taking place in provincial budgets. Now, for this round, because of this update, we have again reverted back to a phasing in there. So the next slide basically shows what the 2007 weighted shares are before the update. For example, in the Eastern Cape it would be 14.8, in the Mbeke 13.1, in the Western Cape 8.8, and then the 2008 weighted shares. So after we've made those updates of those data, those are the new target shares basically for each of the provinces. In the case of the Eastern Cape, it becomes 14.6. The Mpopo goes to 13, and Western Cape increases to 9. So that takes into account all these migration patterns and that there. Now what we see is the difference, and we think that the difference can be, the magnitude of it in brands and cents can be a bit large. So that's the reason why we didn't propose that this is the case in. The next slide now shows basically how this is phased in over the next 3 years. So Eastern Cape will only go down from 15.8 to 15.6 by 2010 and 11, and so the rest are adjusted accordingly there. What Table 8.3 shows is basically the interpretive share after taking into account the beginning of 33 billion that was actually added to the baseline. And what you see basically is quite a large increase from 2008 and 9 and 10 and 10 and 11. They grow quite substantially, despite the revision in the target shares. What W1.6 show is basically for 2008 and 9, the total transfer that will be going to provinces, the total share, the conditional grant. What 1.16 shows is the revision that were made to condition grants. The hospital revised program got 2 billion. And I think we need to mention to the committee is there is the broader discussion around co-funding that needs to be sorted out. The issues around PPP arrangements that need to be taken. These are things that are being discussed there. Now what we have done basically on the equitable share side, we have added roughly about 1.5 billion for health specifically. And what provinces need to do is actually to take 50%, at least 50% of that amount to provide for maintenance as part of their co-funding contribution. Let me talk about this maintenance budget quickly. We'll talk about them tomorrow hopefully as well. What we have picked up, I think the maintenance budget for health was about 1.5 billion. I think it was the Institute of Engineers, South African Institute of Engineers, actually placed the total replacement cost of the capital of hospitals at roughly about 100 billion rand. And if one looks at that 1.4 billion translates to just roughly about 1.5% of that replacement cost. And they indicate that really anything provinces should budget roughly about 2 to 4 and 5% of the replacement cost. Which means provinces for maintenance alone should budget roughly about 5 billion rand. Now if you take that and you put it into schools, where the CSIR, for example, says For schools, the replacement cost is roughly about 170 billion rand for 26 to 30,000 schools that we have. That total, if we also now put another roughly about 4% on that, that total jumps close to about 6.8 billion. So collectively, for schools and for hospitals and health facilities, the maintenance budget for those schools should be close to 10 billion rand per year. For schools, I think the budget is close to about 300 or 400 million rand. How can we got the largest hospital density? And I think, I don't know whether it was correctly reflected in the budget statement, but I think the budget is about 90 million, I'll verify that figure, 90 million a year, which is way, 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 at least. You know, so, on the hospital revive, national government is saying we are bringing in quite a bit of money, but what we expect is the provinces actually to also come to the party in that particular respect. On HIV and AIDS, a further 2.1 billion is added there for the comprehensive HIV and AIDS strategy. The NTLG gets another 1.1 billion. The integrated housing units are 2.2 billion. The 2.7 billion that you see there for infrastructure around the provinces, specifically for education, that goes there. The National School Nutrition Program gets 1.8 billion there. Then 8.5 summarizes basically all the conditional grants that are going to provinces, basically. Those are all the basins going to provinces. Now, incidentally, in our discussion with the SSC actually raised a concern that the share of conditional grants in the system is growing, and they were worried about that. But what was indicated to the SSC is we have only introduced really one new condition grant, which is the one that used by Public Works, the Devolution of Property Rights Fund, which is also a transitional grant. We expect it actually to be phased out in 3 years' time there. So the large growth in condition grants is mainly to step up existing programs, basically funded through those condition grants. On local government, we're increasing the equity share basically by 6.5 billion there. It's a cushion municipality against the delivery cost due to the increases in tariffs. But we also know that the municipal infrastructure grant, the rollout of basic infrastructure has improved quite significantly, and you know, the community survey will indicate that access to water, electricity, sanitation has improved. So once that improves, it means basically the demand for these services by the poor is also increasing, and this is really just to subsidize municipalities and support them basically to be able to cover all beneficiaries of these basic services. Infrastructure in totality that goes to municipalities is set up by 7 billion. I think 3.2 billion of that goes for the World Cup, 1.2 for the stadium, and 2 billion basically for the public transport infrastructure system grant. But on NEG, the 3.8 billion is to continue to roll out municipal infrastructure, but also to provide each municipality at least with a reasonable kind of NEG amount. I think what I said in the beginning of the presentation was we deleted some of the clauses there because we're increasing this and we want municipalities to start to take what your low capacity is, to take ownership basically of some of these programs there. Then the further funding for capacity building there, but also there's I think another 684 million or so that's given to the old cities, because next year by June we will have hopefully the Confederation Cup actually taking place, and the year thereafter. So the money is to operationalize now the actual hosting of those three events. Yeah. Now, a big amount, the broader discussion here for us when we revise the allocations of local municipalities was to specifically look at funding for poor municipalities. Now, I just want to explain what we have done, so that on the mid side, how much money goes to the municipalities and what has happened to the local government because of the share. Now, we are also always driven by the fact that we rather use formula to divide money. Now, we have a call basically from, we get calls from a number of municipalities all the time, where they say the money is not sufficient, we want more money for this and that. I mean, recently, about 2-3 weeks ago, we got a call from Kabazumbi municipality. Not from Kabazumbi, but from a member of parliament, which a constituency is basically in Kabazumbi, says, you know, we need to make a plan so that this municipality gets quite a bit of money. Now, if you get a call from 282 or 83 municipalities, how do you decide which one to give and what you see? So we move away from that kind of approach to rather saying we will use a formula. But what we are saying, and something that we in the Treasury will have to look into, is the issue around, indeed, Kabazumbi is a growing town, right? Now, Kabazumbi may not, for example, have the money now to roll, because before they can even establish a township or expand as a town, you need to do bulk services. So there are certain things that you need to do. Now, if they don't have the money to do it, it means that the town itself, the growth of the town is stifled. You see? So what we say, no, but you can't expect the national government to always come and give you some of the money. So we need to assess the capacity of some of them to borrow, for example, because they can go to the capital market and then they can roll out that infrastructure. And a lot of the people whom they roll out the infrastructure for are people who will have the ability to pay. And in any case, out of the payment, they can be in a position to repay their loan. So is that element that we're saying we have to, in any case, look into. But we clearly are of the view that we need to continue using a formula to divide some of these things. Now, we have tried quite a bit of communication on the local government because of this formula there. And we came to the conclusion that whatever adjustments we make, we don't transfer the money basically to the poorer ones. So we're going to do quite a bit of work this year to see how we can reorganize the local government to this year so that we improve the targeting towards the poorer municipalities. On the mid side, the municipal infrastructure grant, what we have done there is in year one, I think we've increased by 604 million the pool that goes to these municipalities. And I think it's 900 or something, Jonathan, in your two, no? That 1.2 billion and then, right. Now, what we discovered, we can't put in year one, because we were thinking immediately of doing it in 2008 and 2009, so that the minimum allocation for that municipality is 5 million. Now, given the available resources, we couldn't do it. Now, what we have done in the formula, we've introduced a constant. So we've taken the available money in year one and divided it by the number of municipalities who benefit from the grant. And then we've made that the basic allocation to start off with. And then the rest is divided by a formula. We did the same for year two, and then we did the same now for year three, where the base amount in year three now is 5 million. After doing that, we've discovered that we've actually increased these allocations to the four municipalities already in year one to above 3 million. In year two, they are already close to 5 million. And what's happening in year three, they actually go to 6 and actually even exceed 6 million. So there is quite a substantial shift towards the poorer municipalities, basically. So the constant is 2.3 and 8 and 9, 4.4 and 5 and 5 million, basically, in year one. Then W18 basically just summarizes all the transfers that I've made to local, the revision for all the transfers that I made to local government there, and where and which areas they are basically targeted at. W1.9 just summarizes now in totality what are these transfers. W1.21 the different grants and transfers that are made to different municipalities. Then probably 1.23 are the capacity one. The previous one was the infrastructure transfer. This one is the capacity transfer, the capacity building transfer that I made. Now some of the work that's ongoing basically at the local government, at the framework level, in addition to what we're going to do in terms of the local government to go to the fair, is this broader debate around, you know, freedom to think about our mentality is a bit different than what we're currently thinking about. You know, if you look at worldwide plans, we see basically that during the migration towards our bigger cities, we place quite great kind of infrastructure demand on our bigger cities, and how do we really deal with that? But how do we also deal with it in such a way that these big cities are in a position to provide proper infrastructure and not the kind of infrastructure that we currently see? So now we're saying maybe we should think about even a differentiated approach. And that differentiated approach can even mean, you know, once you've got identified 26 or 27 big cities, how they then present plans that show what that city will look like in the next 5 to 10 years or even on the longer horizon. And so that we move away from our accidental way of developing. Because currently you find that houses are being built in some quarters. There's no transport facilities, there's no health facilities, there's nothing. There's a demand for houses that just put these houses down. But at the end of the day, the kind of development that we see doesn't contribute to the kind of community development and social cohesion that we would actually want to see. So we will be looking at that through this differentiated approach. On the RSC levy and Joint Services Board levy, the permanent replacement of that, on page 70 of the budget review, I think there is a paragraph that explains basically what government will be basically, we've looked at a number of options we've engaged with stakeholders, including SAUDA, on this matter, and we actually come to the conclusion that I think the gender fee levy can be one of the better options to replace RSC levy and joint services levies permanently there. And we will be, during the course of this year, basically be looking at how it will then be distributed across that. And yeah, thank you.
Well, this is regarding a bit comprehensive. Of course, it looks like a change, but I think the position of the is probably not short. Just in terms of as a personal effect, and it looks like it is becoming much more tougher and tougher by the day if it's very much easy. And, question? Another piece?
I sometimes wonder if
I do look at, I look at the budget process we got at the budget country, the budget forum, I don't know what other projects, the 4x4, you name all those forums. The purposes of growing the division of revenue. Now sometimes in this interaction, I sometimes wonder if I don't know how to speak it, I don't want to choose my words very carefully so that I'm not seeing to the same thing that I'm not saying. But sometimes I'm not sure if the involvement of provinces, so sometimes when you engage, you don't have the impression that you have been part of this building or other terms they have the interest involved. Because sometimes we pick up for the lack of correct process. Not much understanding of the law. And the role of the call a lot of people digressing most of the time from what is said by the division of everyone. So I'm saying, I'm not sure about you as a kind of the involvement of that, but maybe it would need to be set up. We hear a question about the exclusion now of accreditation clause.
No, popular clause.
Or the popular clause for accreditation. Yeah, you know, sometimes they say people can see, if you can't see them, you find them. I don't know, perhaps whether you're trying to capitulate. Because what Hillary knows and what we all know is that the municipalities will continue to deliver houses irrespective. But what is not there at the municipality is capacity for units within the municipality to deliver and offer of houses. And now this exclusion to us, what does it mean for person? Is it saying now all of us must drive on the freeway now? No robots.
No more apply. During 6 hours.
Yeah.
Some sleep, but the streets are not clean.
So what does it really have to say mean to us? But say what the color commented about that. The other thing is the say of like no. I think that it's good that perhaps the provincial salary are supposed to play a role in terms of infrastructure, provision another fund that are provided for schools, infrastructure for schools and hospitals. However, what they have raised with us continuously is the fact that sometimes I think that Mr. Brown touched on that these monies still flow directly to some of the grants flow directly to those departments. To an extent that there is difficulty for the provincial services to play an effective role. Now, is the thing, from what was presented here, we found here that the schools and municipalities, that one is the minister, but does it mean that all the grants now, all the provinces, will perhaps the provincial salaries
will be informed, will be really made aware of those grants, and therefore played with the political the provincial equitable allocation. We say that I think is the highest. The premier of Kalten last week in the opening of the provincial legislature said that Kalten now is having the highest of the population. Now we know that there is nothing in terms of the principle. So we know that there has not been census since 2001, but there has been community studies existing then. Now, if CZN gets more of the current operation allocation, what informs this allocation? I think we welcome suggesting the special attention that is being paid to the health, also in terms of infrastructure and maintenance. And I would suspect that this the majority of this allocation will come from the provincial executive chair. And if that is the case, would I be correct that there are current agreements by the prime minister that the provinces would really have to prioritize the maintenance of the health centers and the infrastructure comes from your grants, so it's not a big issue. These are the agreements of which so that when the provincial budget have passed, have been started to start it, I mean, take it to start it on table, you'll see there was a solid an improvement in terms of maintenance of the working and giving the food for that matter. The big one for me is that liberalization by several of the need for increasing for me. I think that it is also welcome. However, to what extent are we, also the work that Mr. was suggesting that we really are trying to do more work for the Kuala municipality. Because I suppose that maybe a look at some of the expenditures this year, so before the end of the financial year for housing. And one of the issues that the province is ever raised as an issue is this issue of bulk infrastructure. But I hope that this goes a long way in terms of the
Yes. Let me just check on this thing of accreditation of the municipality. Since we're removing it from the bill, what will the impact be? in terms of training, how the municipality or who the municipality can promise it for. That's the training opportunities for them to solve the problem within themselves. Within training centers, those can. I mean, this accreditation itself is a very difficult to municipality to prevent. They think of raising a concern of whether they will be able to deliver on the article. If you remove it as a condition, will the municipality have the capacity to prevent this thing going forward? And my sense is that if we are still going to be close to the challenge, then my fear is that we return to the state of court before the introduction of association procedures. Unless there is a specific and detailed requirement that this plan be in place and be aligned to the national and provincial financial year training council, which we expect to come out. And besides that is a good condition, but what would be the impact of that with regard to delivering housing? Particularly in terms of the level of the high and the demand side continuously increases. And related to that, and in line with the revision on pavement, when I'm being supported here and asking on behalf of our province, but we have come to the realization that. Oh, I didn't say it. My warning.
With regard to the revision on the baselines, I mean, to what extent is it prepared to engage on the revision on the baselines of the housing transition plan? Because our assessment, from where we sit in the legislature, the real issue is that, however, with the grants increases in terms of education investment, we will never reach a point where we are able to say this money we will be able to do, even if our budget started from 1960. And I think that's the issue that we are engaging with our committee, but we don't have answers. And with regard to the responses to the SFC proposals, I've heard that the treasury will also hold us in the budget forum to agree on how to handle this, but I'm not quite clear for each one of them that specific is going to be done in this one that we are going to have. That for us is a matter that is important. If I can pick one issue, for example, the data on homelessness, I mean, with our problems, that's a very serious issue. But I guess specifically with the Western Cape and the Eastern Cape, and within those problems, specific issues, for example, that have happened. The presence of immigration, both within the province itself, but also affecting people from the continent and other parts of the world. The issue on maintenance, I think all provinces should welcome the fact that there is putting something on the table in respect in relation to maintenance. The difficulty we face at provincial level is that departments, particularly departments responsible for infrastructure, do not plan for the maintenance. And unless treasury interest is something that compels them to put a multi rent for rent in relation to what they receive in the issue of the share, the likelihood increases every year that the maintenance budget will be less. So even that 4 to 5% are significant. Not all provinces can in our examinations of budgets that we'll be doing in the next week, we struggle to find how our public sector is going to for maintenance. And if we do fund, it will be very confusing and dependent on addressing problems rather than paying forward. So, for example, they will argue with us and say that because of the new places that the new infrastructure that they're putting in place, the budget is enough to only meet that demand and not to suffer in issues of maintenance. So that maintenance is one budget that runs the state of depletion of those that infrastructure begins to record or begins to be malfunctioning. And so then you understand. And that is only then so that they begin to plan for maintenance, which is in my view very reactive and going forward will not assist. And I just want to raise a general issue. I think I raised it before in our policy. And that relates to the capacity of provincial departments to spend on the budget program. Specifically on the conditional grant allocation. I think going forward, we have found to do that. In the past, stated that our education department, for example, in the past financial year, in quarter three, or quarter two, or something, had not spent its budget. And I think, to several other things, that reflects not only on the conditional grant, but it also reflects on their extra budget, which is their own disability. So, and my question is, to what extent does Cesar assist or intervene, maybe not assist, because I assume that the local government recruits people that are competent, but to what extent does National Cesar intervene to ensure that budget spent, I mean, department spends within your ability? And within the provisions of the PSM, the quarter to quarter. I mean, you come here and you come to our committee and they indicate that we can't spend this money because in the first quarter we don't have the capacity to do so because we are engaged in planning. So the title doesn't correspond with the budget title doesn't correspond with our planning.
Okay.
First of all, can you say, because we wrote down about 10.
Okay.
Okay, most of my questions have been taken over by my colleague next to me here. And I wanted to appreciate and welcome the attention given to form equality as well as this constant element of introducing the stepping up of the budget. But you mentioned that in some cases in responding to the request by small municipalities, we contemplate looking at options of opening up a window for them to borrow. I don't know, I'm checking there. What criteria do we do that? Also, just to try and make a general approach to the question raised by the colleague about the maintenance. Which, of course, you made a mention that you're worried because most of the time it could appear you only the department is continuous building what's called creating put up new buildings, but the maintenance is not always there. I want to check if there could be a possibility of developing some controls in checking this utilization of this MIG. I'm saying, because I have an observation around local authorities, but I'm saying, where you find that at times it should work, that is done there. When heavy rain come over, they wipe out everything. So, these controls must talk to the situation whereby if now
That project was reported to be finalized a year ago. Then 2 years down the line, we returned again because it's no more there. So I want to take that quality to go on to what we have to do.
Thank you, Chair. Indeed, we welcome the additional allocation. But there is no change. We always have a question about the ability of the beneficiary to use the facility. Here, Chair, I have in mind there is the school. We are having kind of a problem with schools who are saying up to the best point that they have to receive anything to, you know, since they are school teachers, they are police. And judging by a majority of the financial reports, even for the meager funds that they were receiving for from parents, reporting of really not so funny. If it did come, it was of such a nature that it didn't make sense. So then that proved them for the capacity to manage these funds, which would be really bigger than what we used to do. Granted, there you've got SPP members and educators who are not necessarily financial managers and so forth. The issue of capacity would also be acute, as we have already acute, in respect of hospitals. Hospital boards and hospitals themselves are managed, from my observation, mainly by medical professionals, speaking for me, they are not necessarily financial managers, they are not necessarily project managers. Then they cause the question then, do we have some pushing of the funds to look after the capacity? Okay, the last question concerns the allocation to municipalities, especially conditional grants. They were grateful of this funding, especially the consideration given to poor municipalities. That is the same to show it is mostly of men what municipalities want to do to change infrastructure development. That we have municipalities who don't have any possibility of raising on the revenue. For instance, your KS, KS, Naropa, municipalities. The huge population, but there's just no revenue. Thanks for the question.
Thank you, Professor. My name is Tracy from Falcon. I want to find out from Treasury, are they prepared to engage in the new health policy, especially when it comes to funding? We know that most of the time they depend on revenue. And the question is, are the medical police not established under the subject where they're supposed to be helping in time? And I find themselves, especially in hiding, we have a three message. They are mostly concerned about traffic, which we have also the police or the provincial traffic management. And the question will be, the second one will be, what about the bylaws that they're supposed to be helping? Because when you prepare for 2010, you have to prepare on thinking about the bylaws. How are we going to control the sector? How are we going to manage them? And also the bridging of the electricity. those are things that I expect the Metro Police to be doing. And I'm aware that the most of the Metro Police are not actually paid for because we expect them to be looking at their revenue. Are we not actually creating something here where we have the South African Police Services, the Metro Police, and they are not doing what they're supposed to be doing? And now we look also at the announcement of the justice, that the petitioners of justice, saying that they're going to find the people of. I'm aware that at the provincial level we do the oversight on policing, but it's not only, it's an academic consequence. But we have a very low, where we have to get on the CPS and now on the state committee. And all of them, we work together with the municipality. Now you ask yourself a question, who is supposed to be funding us? Because I find the methodology very important to can assist the South African Police Service. And if you can start working on the revenue side of it and understand that you have a provincial management on traffic and also have the necessity, then you can be knowing what to do. Maybe you will need your attention.
Yes. The borrowing of municipalities, like we find out that some of the municipalities are belonging to the city of Kansas. And when the new election coming, the new council coming, and we said that, you know, we can't repay that because of our own council. So I don't know how it's going to be going to deal with that. So the guarantee for that loan from one term to another term for the municipalities. If you go to the open market of the banks and look up, I think they want to guarantee in a certain way that they can go. And also then, I'm glad that the maintenance of assets, roads, buildings, schools, because we both think, I think I mentioned, we don't need to, maybe. So the old one is collected, the other, totally. And the province is, let's say, I'm at a little bit of a concern that provinces have to store maintenance. At the end of the day, they use that money for when they're running out of money, they use it for something else. And that, and it's not a provision ground that they have to use it for that maintenance. They get that money around to be guarding or something like that. Here and then, also, district council, district to the other people. When they transfer money directly to different municipalities, for the poor municipalities, because of what kind of government or capacity. That poor municipality is that low capacity municipality don't receive their money. Special municipalities set to them for 5 or 7 months in that happened. And we found it. They're not receiving that grant in time to maintain or do what they want to do to support that issue. And that was also a big concern. Especially now, there's no need from this account to say that they grant some promise. Also, lack of entry directly, and then they also get some different municipalities, and that's the second. And then here, I think they raise the school fees. I found that school fees are paying very nice school fees. And practically, they receive 5 to 7 months. Into the new collection that is suitable for that area. I haven't got money to buy anything because there's no school fees and they don't receive the money. So it typically is a problem. And asking the meetings from parents just to buy stationery and all that sort of thing. And perhaps we can say that the thing is that what is the report that we're getting from the school services?
But just to say, even once the youth police is doing that, the name of the school that are receiving this money to it. Because we must also approach the National Department of Education and Justice that we start all this money is going to be able to manage to it. Yeah, maybe just to thank very much for that. And I think just to say, well, the something we need on the take up in our system, just for achieving the money, but I think it's a trend generally. Yeah, even in 5 days, we'll get the money around September, October, and so on. So, they have to survive the whole year without the allocation. whilst we have a world-class financial institutions in the country, so it's something we need to take up to make sure that quarterly some tranche of the money that's happened up to see collected money that the necessities must go to them. I think that many of the issues have been raised. I think the report is very easy for everybody to comprehend. We would like to welcome. My own issue is the case. One is the full levy. The RFP levels will be done away with, and then we will use the full levy to deal with some of the questions. I wanted to get a comment around the. Because of the volatility of the oil market, that fuel level has been a constant amount in the previous year. What would be the impact? I think that's one issue. The second issue is around the risk. I think there are many issues that are important around transport, serving rates, around 15 and so on. But I think in our province we have an issue. Because we wanted to call some of the roads, provincial roads, to receive some of the money and use it for maintenance and so on. But and the problem of roads is a national function, so there's a lot of difficulty between the province and Tundra around discussions on how these issues need to be handled and so on. I don't know if you can have any advice to us on how we can do some of the things. Yeah, but I think the rest of the comments are very helpful around the kind of performance quality, the concern around the increasing number of conditional grants of this particular person. It's an important point that there is in there. And I think, you're under the top addresses many of the concerns that we have.
Has it really resolved the demarcation finger? You know, we're going to have problems about demarcation issues like that are not addressed. I think that's the one thing. Number two, OSD. Is there a normal standard there? What's the approach? It would be nice if you can share with us, for example, you gave Limpopo 144 million grants. As a parent, you needed 300 million. And I still living with that legacy as a speaker in terms of what the national experience. And so, what informs your allocations in terms of the policy? We give a number. As you were saying to Limpopo when you were there, did they then resuscitate some of the goals to attend that when the money was so due? And I think 239 is very much welcome, and I just want to add colleagues to, it's one of the critical areas that you must know, also watch carefully, preparation for the next financial year. I mean, because we've been talking about this planning all the time, and I think I'm happy now that it is very in the law. Especially, we must be able to check with some tools, as the clause says there. But then the other one is, we've got to harp upon our accreditation. You see, because that clause was brought into DORA precisely because the Housing Act does not accredit. And I'm not sure what's going to ensure that it gathers this now. But that's my worry. That's the one thing. But number two, there has been a deliberate action by provincial treasury. Northern Cape Provincial said to us last time here, municipalities opt to be housing developers. And you say, no, there's no option. Capacity must be built to ensure that municipalities, firstly, become then developer. They can't just off. So this thing is going to proceed unabated. I think the numbers are correct. And it does worry us a bit. Because there's so much financial damage in that regard. Northwest Floridians have done so in the last 2 or 3 financial years. Just pulling money as responsibility. And they are taking over that responsibility again as a province. Whereas other provinces are just pulling this thing back in reality. And I think, and I think as a member of the thing, removing this clause is going to open some form of interdicting some terrible blanket. Only GRC is not assisted. It has its own problems. Mr. Sogonia, when he was in the Eastern Cape, was saying they must talk to. But part of the problem is caused by energy GRC itself. We also worried about its own capacity. In fact, we are inviting them during our hearing in this sector housing. Precisely because we want to deal with those things. What also worries me is the schedule for grants. This thing that there's no reporting, because some of these things is subsumed in some of the programs, creates some, I think, habits in terms of reporting. And especially for cars. So clearly, for now, we are not seeing the outcome clearly for cars. So I do have a problem myself about that, and I think it must be really, really, very considered. Because in fact, it's always our view as a community here. That conditional grant must be phased into the equity itself when we are able to see the outcome properly. Immediately you rush into subsuming this money, it just gets lost. This became clear when we were having this hearing in the last quarter. Where we've been told by National Treasury Finance that there is dedicated funding for ECD in the equitable share. But it's not feasible. It's not possible. See, the money that is increased here for roads and other things, it's going to get lost somewhere. Again, it means provincial treasurism, all of us must be very, very vigilant to guard this. We can tell you now that Northwest Province has many pockets of development funds, about 10 departments have development funds. So clearly, again, this new funding that is coming is going to get lost somewhere there. And so the monitoring is going to be again a bit difficult.
I've received a note from my colleague here from South End. He says, I must rectify the statement of the population in South End exceeding that of previous end. I think that he's trying to remind me of a certain energy reminded you that in some areas in culture. So it means that because of that, it's good that not many people know what I didn't say. You're the only one who knows what I didn't say. So it cannot exceed that of KZN, and that it has grown for what culture area. It has grown. But I'm happy with that. But if I can take this opportunity, just a clarification of which was not mentioned in terms of the changes to this particular act. Section 40, clause 32. It's about the liability for cost in cash during the violation. I'm not sure if it was in the past, but maybe I didn't take notice of it, but this is also in the past. Because maybe I must have assumed that the Spirit Care Resolution Framework Act, that is called the Intergovernmental Framework Act, I have assumed that it takes care of many things. So, thank you for talking.
All right, that's the last two. One, we have said to DPRC, and we hope that something has also been done by itself. In respect of the very formal policies, which NIG is requesting, have we affected the capacity to do? In fact, almost all the various families are not able to absorb the current family. And so the new family, should they be ready to absorb the new family? But I also see here that there is a municipal disaster grant. When I read that, I thought that there's a cross-cutting contingent in that community that just kicks in when there are these problems.
Thank you very much. I think what I'll do, I'll start with the easy question. And he's the most difficult one for most of you. Oh, and Jonathan. Mr. Sukwani, you are right. The population of Gauteng is indeed larger than the population of KZN. Actually, if you turn to page 65 of the Division of Revenue Power, you will see that the community survey says there's about 10.45 million people in Gauteng and 10.3 million, page 65. But in terms, now let me bring it in relation to what happens in the Equitable Check. Now in the Equitable Check, we don't take into account only population. There are certain things that we take into account. There are the number of learners, people work without medical aid and all of that. And if you look at the structure of the 10.5 million people in Gauteng, you just need to pay, you don't have to even pay further. You're going to see the number of people who have medical aid of the 10.5 are far larger than the number of people who have medical aid in KZN, for example. So we cater them more for people without medical aid. Oh, is that agree? Sure. If you look at incidentally, the people who come to Gauteng are people who come to work in Gauteng and they leave their kids wherever they are to attend school. And we will see in the numbers, actually, if we turn to page...
Is that Mr. Brown? Did somebody
mention that? Did you say, how gender has the top end of this country? Yeah. 67 is young. Yeah. So if you look at page 67, and you look at school enrollment, for example, you're going to see that in Gauteng, in terms of 2007 school enrollment, you've got 1.9 million learners. And in KZN, you've got 2.8 million learners. So once you see all of these things together, then you get the distribution that you actually get. But what we will do for the workshop open tomorrow is to highlight some of those things. You're not to see your problem. Yeah. Now let's talk about the issue around monitoring of these grants, because what Mr. Zubania said is the Treasury is saying that, you know, particularly with conditional grants, they can't monitor them given how these things are transferred. You know, let me be blunt, if the Treasury is saying that you then they are alive, because what the Treasury is giving us, the Section 32 report, and its responsibility in terms of the PFMS is to monitor each and every cent that is transferred to the province and that is expended basically in the province. So clearly the information and the systems that are there and the information that we get suggests that the provincial treasuries are indeed on top of the game when it comes to...
Agency of the Department
say 14%
and the National Department
is about. So you're right, but part of the problem we are raising ourselves is that even provincial treasurers are really not assisting us. Because he's also right, some of the treasurers, just when they came here, they were not even aware of some of the clauses we read in the Bible, which is the beginning of government act. They would then say, hey, I'm not aware of this. It's another matter we shall raise ourselves, and this is why I was saying Section 39 is critical here now. And I think we need some discussion maybe some meetings or without gatherings. Just to run through some of these questions, please. Just to check for the readiness also of the presence. You remember for the Eastern Gate presence had some capacity problems not long ago. So for really, the some of those problems.
No,
definitely. No, so here, just I think I'm learning from this practice as well.
Okay.
So I think on that issue, the reality that we face is that it's true that provincial and national presence we see it's more compliant, but it's more compliant. Because when we say and go further on our department, what is it that we are reporting? I am reporting the transactions that go through the cash flow, the program on a daily basis, monthly, quarterly, and then consolidating that. While also reporting on non-financial transactions. Do you indicate to the government that, okay, on this program, you've received so much, you've sent so much per quarter, this is how, where you are. And these are the outputs in the terms of what you are supposed to have received. And we find that, sir, that in most instances, in fact, our commercial program does say that in most instances, it has to go back to the department and speak to the department and go through that process again, because the data is not sure. Simply times numbers on the basis of the linear thing, because you must spend 50% or 25% in the first quarter. And therefore they report that they spent 25,000. Okay. And that doesn't correlate to non-financial
transactions.
Yes.
Yes, well, I shall break it again. The recalculation and the photo. From the last information drop of that 10 million. Yeah, well, I see Yemenpoko has less population than the northern side of Northwest. So this is
possible.
The money must be going to the northern side. I can see the population of Yemenpoko is bigger than Somalia.
No, we will fix that. No, the allocations are actually correct. What the gentleman from Hotel is saying is indeed true, and you have been part of our discussions in the Budget Council all the time around monetary, particularly on the financial side, and the challenges that are actually coming up, basically as it's related. In terms of systems, the system closed, for example, on the 10th day of each month for the previous month. And I think once the system closed, the department then provides its spending for that month and preceding month and projections moving forward, provided to the provincial treasurer. And the provincial treasurer is precisely what you're saying, needs to then interrogate some of the spending to see what makes sense, what does the projections make sense, and all of that there. That is before they then submit it to us on the 22nd, basically, of that month. Now, when that information comes to us on the 22nd of that month, we also have some kind of a process where we interrogate some of the numbers. And in many instances, our budget analysts in our unit there interact again with the treasury, raising specific questions when it comes to financial reporting. Now, we are winning a bit of a battle on that side. But the point that we are making is linking that now to actual performance, because you have promised to do certain things with the money. So you show that you spend the money. But on the non-financial side, how do you see whether you indeed achieving the objective that you said you're going to achieve? Now, it took us basically close to 5 or 6 years to let you perfect very cautiously to get the financial side of it right. And I think we are in the third year now of really working on non-financial stuff, and we hope really to improve that non-financial part of that reporting actually moving forward. Mr. Fogg, on the issue around priorities and agreement. Now, this has been basically, in fact, let me start with the first point that you made, where the department, say, of education in the province will say, but we don't know about these priorities. That if they're really going to say that, then clearly, there is a problem within our intergovernmental system. Because we are interacting basically with treasury and with sector departments coming from the provinces for each and every sector, and when we're talking about the HOD for education, we may be talking to them maybe two or three times basically a year on a continuous basis on what these priorities are. The Department of Education nationally also talked, at least we hope so, within the headquarters around some of these priorities and how that would be then informing the division of revenue, basically. Now, the challenge that we've picked up is most often the priorities that the National Department of Education with all of these issues sitting around the table presented to the Treasury are in many cases not what the Education Department in Gauteng, for example, would see as a priority. You may see as a priority, say, or even recently, security in schools, for example. But what the Education Department and National would put forward would be something different. Now, the problem that arises is once that money then gets to the next, to the Provincial Department of Education, they think of what their priorities initially were and try to catch those ones up. And it is an issue that where we sit, we need to basically look into. Now, what we are doing is in December, once these budgets are at least in a very kind of draft form, they are submitted to us. And we call in the treasurers in December. They present this one. We look at what the budget looks like and what the priorities were, and we ask the questions that we're asking. Why is there a mismatch? Is there a particular kind of mismatch? Then we advise provincial treasurers to actually they have time to go back and relook at some of this and finalize the budget. Then in January again, they come back and then we again look through this budget to see that whether that alignment is there. What we have picked up, for example, in January was we have allocated those 2.7 billion for school infrastructure through the infrastructure grant, for example. But when you look at the infrastructure budget of education departments across the country, we found that of the 2.7 billion, actually I think just about a billion has been allocated. The other 1.7 billion has gone somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So I think there, for example, the minister was quite clear that, look here, you need to go back and fix this budget. We can't be operating in that. In fact, even if you assess that budget thoroughly, you're going to see the case of N and I think Western Cape, where the two provinces that actually aided quite far more than was actually given to them. Which means they have cross-authorized all the other problems. So we have that problem when it comes to concurrent functions. And I think it is one of the biggest challenges, in any case, in determining the budget for provinces. And we hope that, this review of the white paper on provincial government and that will also address some of these things. But it remains really a challenge. That's the reason why the national ministry has this edginess to either introduce more conditional grants so that they can monitor and control what they have there, or when they say, give the money to me, I will implement it myself. And that is where we say the system cannot operate basically in that session. On need, let me try and use the word quite too, very, my word carefully. I don't think the intention of need is really to fund policy infrastructure. Now, before I actually get to that, one disturbing trend actually on the MIG side is we have increased MIG substantially over the past four or five years. But what we've seen, as we increase MIG, the municipalities are now decreasing their share. Basically, that then goes to municipal infrastructure. So they start to then use this thing to buy fancy motor things, beautiful cars. And actually, I was really shocked at one meeting 2-3 years ago when I raised that particular kind of thing. So the stairs that they go. Oh, yeah. But clearly, municipalities that have got the resources really need to come to the party when it comes to to the funding of the Ministry of municipal infrastructure, basically. That. On the housing condition grant, I think as you said, you know, the money is not sufficient. And I think we need to accept the money will never be sufficient, even if we take it from our own budget perspective. But what we're saying in this differentiated approach, because that is where it will help us. Well, let me step up on that. 3 years ago, how the funds were divided through the housing formula, it was quite, I wouldn't say biased more towards rural provinces, but it was giving quite a bit of litter in terms of size vis-a-vis the demand for this urban kind of center. So what was done 3 years ago, the grant was increased substantially, but at the same time it was given quite a bit of an urban bias. Even that urban bias was done in such a way that the rural provinces didn't lose out. They still got quite a bit of money. So yes, the share that will then go to the city centers, the big urban cities and the metros in particular, is quite a bit large. But there's something else that actually needs to be addressed when it comes to housing. When it comes to housing, we need that kind of long-term planning. Money alone will not solve the problem. The current approach will continue to result in disjointed kind of communities. If you think about housing and you look at your settlement, say as you drive through La Mesa on the Golden Highway, you see the settlement on the right hand side, as you go up Zagaria Park on the left hand side, you go over that settlement, you get quite large informal kind of settlements on both sides actually of the road. And you move further. What do you see? You don't see those houses. You don't see a proper transport infrastructure that supports, for example, those people. I don't think I've seen a school in that particular area. Alright? So no clinic. Now, those people are far removed even from economic activity. Now, what we are saying with a differentiated approach is to say, look here, we need to allow these cities. Before I get to that, you're going to have quite an extensive way of providing a lot of other support infrastructure. Because it means you need to have transport facilities for that particular area that I'm referring to. Now go into the Ikuru lane side, you're going to have. Now what we're saying of long-term planning, why is it that we don't have quite a bit of a strategy that we say within this particular confine, this is how we will deal with the delivery of housing. So that we then concentrate the development in a particular kind of zone, so that once you put in transport infrastructure, then the transport infrastructure supports quite a wider kind of area within that area of development. And that is where we say maybe we need to rethink how our macro really work. And it touches on the housing function where it should be located. And I think the white paper on local government itself and that raises this issue around where the housing function itself basically should be located. So money alone is not going to solve the problem. Actually, if you don't do it with proper planning prior to that, it's going to create quite a bit of other problems for us. Now let me touch on the point that you're raising on homelessness, right, and the collection of data. Now currently the housing formula is using that, and we agree with the FSC that we need to collect this information, but how do you collect this information where you've got this large kind of migration of people with not only into Gauteng, for example, but also around Gauteng, where you've got the person living in fact, the person is there because there's an economic opportunity for that person within that area. But if that economic opportunity ends, that person moves to another area where they get another opportunity for economic activity in that area. How do you even measure homelessness within that particular kind of environment? Becomes quite a bit of a challenge there. But to get to your point there, I think your point was we need to have time frames where you say when will we solve this thing? And that point is well taken. Yeah. When it comes to maintenance, the maintenance of infrastructure, I don't buy that there's no capacity to maintain it. What we are telling services is, now, if you maintain a school, what does school maintenance mean? It means probably painting a school. It means if a door is broken, it must be fixed very quickly. If a drain is blocked somewhere, it must be fixed quickly. Now, why can that responsibility be given to a principal? And say, as a principal, you will be responsible to maintain this. And give the money and transfer that money directly to the school. Obviously, you need to put the checks and balances in place to ensure that once the money reaches, indeed reaches the school, that the money will be spent, basically, for that particular purpose. Now, let me, in my previous life, I was a school principal. I'm a school principal. Now, I am from Joburg. I'm from there. But I was a school principal when you could play. Now, what happens if the toilet is broken or the drain is blocked, there's a specific number I was given to call in Cape Town. So I'll call the number. Somebody in public also will pick up the phone. I'll explain my problem and that person will give me a reference number. And that person will say, if this thing is not fixed within the next 2 or 3 days, use this reference number and then we will sort the person out who didn't actually do the job. And within 2 days, the school, whatever was the problem within the school, was fixed. But, I mean, it's really simple kind of thing that people need to be doing. And then people are then also not doing simple things, basically like that. So, in terms of capacity, yes, but it may be how people organize themselves as a business that becomes quite a bit of a problem, because you may have a lot of people actually there, but people not doing their job. Now, coming back to the point that you've raised around the monitoring of school funds, because what we want to see is really for the money to reach the school. Right? That's the reason why we include the clause now that actually the province must direct each transfer going to make to the school. So that the school principal knows I'm entitled to this and then can follow up basically on that. But within the school setting, you've got districts, you've got circuits, you've got all of those things. The responsibilities of those districts and circuits are precisely to monitor what is happening within the school. And I think the ratio of a school manager to I think number of schools is, in some cases is close to one circuit manager for 20 schools, which is a manageable thing because the circuit manager is in a position or to visit all the entities, not only to look at the curriculum, whether they are teaching, but to look at all of these other things. So if you don't strengthen those kinds of things, we will continue to have problems with monitoring the performance and that. Now in last year's budget, incidentally, we have added quite substantial money to improve precisely district management, for example, in school. And it is something that can be used to hopefully resolve some of the problems that are basically there in terms of success. Or mostly schools. It is amazing what reaction the media can actually draw. When this story broke actually in Gauteng, because it was predominantly last year in Gauteng. And you can have, I think within a week or two of the story breaking, that issue was gradually resolved. But granted, there's another point to it where we need to have a payment schedule so that a school can know when to expect the money within its bank account. And in many cases, some of the schools, some of the departments try to transfer the school right in the money right in the beginning of the financial year so that you don't have chances, so that the money is available in any case for the school throughout the year. Yeah. Incidentally, 2 weeks after the story broke, there was a story about health and hospitals in Gauteng, where the health facilities didn't get all the money that was due to them to do certain things. So I flew to Cape Town, and I think it was the day when the MEC for Education also came to the MCC. So, but I didn't see the MEC, so I saw the gentleman that was with the MEC there. I said, hey, bro, I see you in a plane, did you transfer the money to the MEC? Very important, and I saw it was the MEC in the track. She was laughing, but I think she also realized, I mean, it is quite, a bit of a serious problem. Now, let me just see what else is there. Maybe I should give myself a little bit of a moment. Well, let me keep going here. On borrowing, what criteria is used? I think the NSMA, I'm not sure which sector within the NSMA, they are clear of how borrowing really needs to be managed here. And I don't know how to answer your question around when there's a change of government. How do you deal with the liability of the previous government? But in my view, it shouldn't really be an issue. It's one of the really things about that. On the maintenance of municipal infrastructure and the rest, I think Mr. Fuzil, you can go through some of this too, Mr. Pirate.
Now let me go through some of these questions and comments, which are quite rich, I may say. Look, the issue of bulk infrastructure for smaller municipalities, I think it does demand itself. And if you think about, say, any typical municipality, if it receives, say, now it's going to be sort of 3 million in May, that would be a very small project. You can't probably put up a sort of water reservoir that's big enough to supply an area with sufficient pressure, well designed and situated, and also maybe if you're thinking of having waterborne storage system put up to storage processing plant and so on. So that's an issue that we've got to find a way to deal with in time, in the way in which the allocations work. Strict public finance theory, which doesn't work in real life, would suggest that services such as those are supposed to be self-funded. In other words, you can even say, okay, borrow in order to pay over time for the service once it's up. But there are places where that, as I say, theory wouldn't work. You know, the mere fact that you have a free basic service is a response to a recognition that there are places where you just leave the people on their own, they would suffer. So that's something that we would welcome kind of a discussion in terms of how to deal with it, and building also on the experience that we have had with the bulk infrastructure plan for water services for some kind of thing. Excuse me. Now, let me just use the words that the Honorable Member used in relation to maintenance. If we don't introduce rules soon in the respect to maintenance, we probably will not move in the direction that we ought to move in. That's the bottom line. And it can be partially a money problem, but I also think that it's also just a mindset problem, which probably has got to be changed through rules, because persuasion is not going to work. I mean, one sees this even with people. Some people drive their car until it stops. They don't see the need to keep changing things when this thing is still working. Whereas others would be more cautious to say, look, certain items have got a lifespan, I don't want to be stranded along the road, let me just replace things at certain points. So we welcome that, and it's something that we're considering quite seriously in the period ahead. In respect to the issue of capacity, it applies both in fact to municipalities and departments that receive grants. There are various initiatives that have been put in place, but honorable members will certainly be surprised to hear that. In many instances, when you put up a support program, you can call it Project Consolidate, change the mindset, the infrastructure delivery improvement program, there are no paper solutions. It is an amazing thing. It's like dealing with people, I've heard about this, I've never been in that situation. who are alcoholics. So he says, you know, the person will not admit, and by the time they admit it's very late, but it's better when they get to that stage, because then it's easier to help them. So the one of the difficulties, and this is a difficulty we encountered with education in housing, when we started the infrastructure delivery improvement project, the Honorable Member used that department as an example. We started to look, you have got a problem with infrastructure. Here is the support program that we're putting up. You are close to us, he said twice. We would be very happy to place a person who was 50. There is no, we don't need your help. We will fix our problem. Now, it was only when, it was strange, it was only when, I think after the third quarter in that financial year, when we presented the report at the PCC, Presidential Coordination, the President's Coordinating Council, and we showed that Helton was not going to spend this infrastructure money. And Premier Shiloh took exception to this. He said, look, I can't have the Department of Education that's doing it. And he appreciates the central role that Helton Department of Education has to play for the country, because it's attracting too many people. Some of us will go to Helton with our kids. I'm like, go believe them. Okay. But so in a way, we then took steps, and that's when we began to work with Helton to assist them with that problem. I'm saying, this actually tends to apply almost everywhere. And usually, until there is an acceptance in the place that has to be helped, the help does not work. Because often, whoever returns to a municipality or a province has got to get into the system there and has got authority to try anything, and may not even know who to ask for things and where to take things, so they depend entirely on the system that they find. Which is why it becomes useful. I mean, I'm saying that we reported this matter to the PCC, and we sometimes play these things up, you know, intentionally. Not to get people into trouble, but to say to them that you can't stand in the way of helping people. You may have authority, but it doesn't mean that you use it to stand in the way of progress. So, in a way, what we sometimes have been encouraged our treasury colleagues is to say, we get the report, the law requires us to publish it, but we must look for avenues to move to make sure that this report brings light into the system. If you have got members of the provincial legislature who are very keen, as one of the friends here, to use the information to put pressure on people to change things, then use this and give them the information, because they don't have it to help them do that. So I'm saying that insisting on getting this report and beginning to say to the department, Honorable Member, when they show that they will spend equal amount every month for the next 6 months, to say to them, look, this can be true. And you can even show them what actually transpired the previous year. Say, look, this does not happen in real life, so why are you giving us something that doesn't mean anything? What we have then also introduced at the behest of the Department of Education is Section 27.2 in this bill. We cannot provide for instances where if a provincial department fails to carry out its function, which is funded through a conditional grant, then the national department. Yes. Okay, sorry, sir, so misleading. 26.2. Then the national department concerned can step in and assist to make sure that the spending takes place. The issue on the window for borrowing, the borrowing issue is a solution, but not for small municipalities, because they hardly have what people would call a balance sheet. You know, they've got very meager revenue streams, sometimes very erratic, so they've got little to show to potential creditors. Where the issue of borrowing becomes critical is in the certain municipalities that are reasonably well capacitated, that have got reasonably strong balance sheets. And there are several of them in the country. It's not just, people stop with the six metrics. But if you were to take a place like Buffalo City, Polokwane, Msimbuzi, you name all of these means, they are big enough that they can borrow substantial amounts. Now, if they were to borrow, and we should probably look at incentives that force them in a positive sense to think about borrowing, because if they were to access the capital market, and they can at reasonable prices, then that would ease a great space for national government to use the fiscal to target more resources towards the poorer municipalities, because the cake that spread is finite. And indeed, some of them are looking at the option of borrowing, but what one would find saying is that they tend to run to the BBSO, which I think in its inception was intended to help the poorer ones more. So it is loaded with debt from messaging and things like that. Now, I must say, around the issue of ensuring that what is delivered measures up to the cost, establishing quality, serving something that's beyond us where we see. But I mean, I wouldn't know how to deal with it. It relates to the issue that the Honourable Kant was raising about just the effectiveness of spending. But I mean, can I just add to what Mr. Brown said in respect of who is not receiving money on time? I think he's right that it could be useful to introduce payment schedules which indicate when the money should be expected. But I also think that the honourable members will probably want to talk to their colleagues in the respective committee, say for education and for health, to say, look, can't you ask the Department of Education to give you a safe, even if it's not public, that says we transfer our first installment to schools by this date, second installment by this date, and what they require from the schools before they transfer and decree that. And then, a week or two after the date of the transfer, call the official, or you can say, can you please then a week or give us a report, a written report, that says you have transferred to this school, you have not transferred to this one, and the reasons that they follow, these are the steps you are taking. But also assure us, in addition to the steps you are taking, beyond just writing the difference, they have not given us a report, so your money is not coming, because the person who is supposed to submit the report may not have the, you know, the feeling and the desire that, look, I have to do this thing because there are kids who will suffer if I don't come. But they just even say, they have not given me a report, so I'll wait for it. You know, say to them they must also provide with information in terms of steps that they will take to make sure that by a certain date, no matter what, the money gets transferred. Because not transferring the money to the school means that the school may not pay electricity, may not pay for water, may not pay for a whole host of things that move the school function. So it can be something that you live with forever. But the other issue that we don't, I mean, do properly, and I think it's kind of a country problem, is that sometimes we move back and forth to get somewhere. For instance, the issue that the Honourable raised about policy. There are several issues to this, and I'm not very well conversant with them. Perhaps I'm not the best person to answer the question, but let me make the following attempt to give a partial answer. The one issue is that the training of the SACF and the Metropolis is different to what I understand. Well, the police officers will be trained quite thoroughly on the Criminal Procedure Act, because they've got to find people and know that this is a crime committed and be able to put together evidence that can stand in a court. But the Metro Police may be exposed to a bit of that, but the bulk of their training tends to be focused more on, you know, like the bylaws, you know, what are the things that people can do within the city, which sort of sometimes differ from one place to the other, but also aspects of the road traffic, the Act of Traffic Management Act. Now, what I know, I use this final matter whether we take a step forward and backward to move some more, because I understand that there is a process of who, at least reading from newspapers, to sort of manage these services. And I presume there are problems that people have realized in terms of how they work. But you are right that it only makes sense for such a service to be provided, for policing to be provided nationally. But the network has done this thing on their own accord. The fact that they saw a need is a different matter. They did it on their own accord, and when they first considered it, we were trying, those of us were to advise them against it, but they were advancing reasonable reasons, because they said that if they sign it in our jurisdiction, then investors don't come, then our town doesn't grow. Which makes sense. So it's, like I said, it's a kind of a half answer to your question. People who own the DBSA, it's a very, it's a kind of a bad thing. I mean, if the democratic government in South Africa could not walk away from apartheid debt, I wouldn't understand or know how to describe the situation where one democratically elected government would have to walk away from commitments that have been made by another democratically elected government. It's beyond me. Mr. Botha, there are no districts will no longer receive money on behalf of local municipalities, precisely because of the problem that we articulated. We realize that because then the district acts as though the money will not come from them. The problem that we will still remain with, though, in our system, is with respect to the fact that the assignment of function and power still does hold the power. You do get districts that may still, for instance, have a water function, water function. But practically on the ground, the function is delivered by a local municipality. So the district then go to the local municipality and say, can you do this thing on our behalf? We will pay you. And the local municipality is still there delivering the service. And ordinary people like me don't know when they see the service coming that this one is delivering it on behalf of someone else. So when the district then does not give the money to the local municipality, often the local municipality finds the situation has got to continue with the service, although it's not getting the money. That is something that we think needs to be fixed in the system as part of this review of powers and functions, because it does create problems. I mean, one municipal manager wrote to the minister, not even to the director general or us mere mortals, to say, minister, we have used all the need money now to pay salaries, and next month we will not have money to pay the salaries, we need to make a plan. you get paid things like that. Honorable member, you're asking another very valid question. In respect to the fuel levy buoyancy, that's of the buoyancy of RSC levy, that's an issue that does concern us. But what we noticed was that although RSC levy at certain times tend to go very, very fast compared to the fuel sale, generally the sort of trend lines are not very far apart. That's the one issue. But the second issue is that we have looked at a range of options. I mean, we are close to a stage where we almost face a choice between continuation of a grant and this. And it's better to have this, because it still leaves municipalities with a bit of, a lot of autonomy. But it's probably not as much as they have on the other level. But we are also looking at devolving further taxes to municipalities to even make up for those volunteers that they occur. These questions are quite many, I think. But let me try to pick. There are no further demarcation hang-ups. Northwest is still sort of struggling to swim following this thing, but they are out of intensive care. The issue of the tolling of roads in Southern is a unique problem, because crisscrossed by several national roads, which would make sense to call, but they don't belong to Khalifa. That's one issue. The second issue is that somewhere in the rules of toll roads in South Africa, there's a provision that says that if you toll one road, people must have another road so that they can avoid the toll. They must not be forced to. Yeah, something like that. So that's one of the dilemmas that Southern faces, that if you want to call anyone, this is what comes to the area, you must provide people with an alternative to that. The OSD issue is a direct question, which I hope to deal with adequately. There are a couple of issues that arise in relation to this. The first one is not the province's problem. It relates to the fact that it looks like the rules or the argument in respect to OSC was left somewhat open-ended, such that it was not inconceivable in certain instances that the province could define a mess was just qualified as a specialist mess and therefore deserving to be remunerated at a level far higher than really expected, you know, and deserving of someone with a specialist qualification and the necessary experience. That's problem number one. It was not problem to go under, I would say, national government problem. But, having said that, if I were a problem, I would have stopped to ask the question, how come that someone who qualified yesterday can be paid as much as someone who qualified 10 years ago? I would have, you know, I'm just saying that that's the one issue. The second issue, I think that so that explains part of the difference between 144 and 300 million. The second bit relates to the fact that I think there has been a bit of opportunity, and I would call it an element of mystery, among the government. When they saw this kind of loose definition, they decided, okay, let's treat our people nicely. Because this was a national determination, we ask for more. Now, I think they are going to have to think twice now. Because it has resulted in an anomalous situation. I mean, Gauteng has got more nurses in absolute number, better qualified nurses, not just because it's Gauteng, and the cost of this is less in Gauteng than it is in Limpopo. So the people of Limpopo have got something to explain on this matter. Now I can see that they make it someone else's problem entirely when they explain this thing. Mr. Kalala, I see you are able to take your program. They are a bit of a complication in the system. Because we have, I mean, the taking programs have got to be introduced with the clauses that are applicable to them because of their unique nature. If you take CAF, CAF wants to do things that provinces have been doing since they existed. Provinces have been supporting emerging farmers, providing them with a range of services. Perhaps CAF provides more than has been provided. Now, the system, the financial system, just even from the program structure, there is a farmer support program in a budget of a typical budget of a provincial department of officials. It lumps these things together, the objectives of the state. The grant then wants to add to those things. It becomes a problem that you can't define it differently. You can't say this grant wants to do these things, but, you know, it's not quite for us at all. That's the different difficulty that we encounter. How we have circumvented this problem in other areas is to say to departments, report on everything that you do with this program. Because the interest of national government is in fact not in knowing what its limited contribution achieves. If you want to know what's happening in the respect of farmers, you want to know what happens to farmers as funded by the rest of government, national and provincial contribution. That's how we have circumvented it. So it may be a way to go for some of the programs. Now, you can't apply it in all of them entirely, because if you take national social services and then you can get mountains of reports because it funds all the social services. You don't want to get all of that stuff as well, because it's kind of like the process.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have left the presentation for the air.
Luckily, can I also answer my easy question first? On section 42, the provision has been in DORA since I arrived to Chaser in 2004, so it's always been there. It doesn't sort of contradict the Intergovernmental Relations Framework Act. This is basically just deals with the cost implications that should not follow that legislation. So it's built on Chapter 3 of the Constitution, but it's also built on the Intergovernmental Relations Framework Act. So it's just saying that if you incur costs in contravention of those, you will be held personally liable. I think the accreditation one is the clause on accreditation has been in DORA for 3 years. It's been completely ineffective. So what we tried this year is we changed our practice completely. So if you look at Section 39, it's now quite an intricate clause. The fact is that basically what the old accreditation clause said, it took sort of the Housing Act requirements and goals on it to put specific time frames in it. So it wasn't, those rules were still in place in terms of what constitutes accreditation, who does what, etc. So that's all still in us, the piece of legislation. But what we've tried to do in 59, if you look at 59, 39.3.8, it says that the indicative allocations for next year and the two forward-looking years must be agreed by the 1st of October. And those allocations must be agreed between the receiving officers and the municipalities, which is the province and the municipalities. And those municipalities are identified by the National Minister of Housing. They fail to identify those municipalities. We've also in a provision to say that National Treasury will identify those municipalities. And we've also created the dispute resolution mechanism. One currently is for the Minister of Housing to facilitate dispute resolution between provinces and municipalities. But also in terms of the NSMA, any municipality can also approach the National Treasury to assist in dispute resolution. So we just try to do it a little bit differently. Instead of harping on the accreditation and trying to force implementation of the Housing Act, we've changed the law to say there's certain municipalities that will be identified. You shall negotiate with them in terms of what you can transfer in the next 3 years. Should you fail to do so, basically we'll determine what those allocations will be. Who the municipalities will be and who the allocations will be. So I think it's just a completely different approach in terms of trying to address the issues. And also in the interim, we've provinces utilize public or national or provincial public entities to deliver their housing functions. We've also put in a provision to say that they must report on transfers to those public or entities, the specific amount of the transfers and the expenditure. So for instance, if we can say transfers 50% of its allocation to the housing function to the legal homes, then I still report in terms of exactly what is being transferred and what is being expended. So that one can keep track in terms of what the housing expenditure is, because currently they don't report on that.
One more time. Okay.
The honourable member from Cabinet asked about the revision to take an allocation for the housing grant. I know that in Cabinet this is quite a big issue. In the immediate term, one of the things that we have done is to introduce this clause, which the Parliament passed, is to allow reallocation. You will be aware that Cabinet has received $750 million from funds that were sought to be sent to. What one would hope for, honourable member, is a situation where within the housing sector they need to keep debating what's the best approach in the state of the housing. Because in no year, in the 10 years that I've worked as a president, do I recall a situation where the housing grant was objected countrywide. And that's one of the issues that has made it very hard to make a case. Although every year the grant has money added to it. For substantial step changes to this grant. Because
the overall thought is never exhausted. So there is no point in adding to something that's there. So we believe that within the grant, among the nine provinces, there has to be a way to manage the cost that the places where the need is higher and where the speed to deliver is faster, transcendent. That's just one thing that the sector on its own should be able to do. The second issue that needs to be thought through, and it may not be a housing sector issue alone, it's a major policy issue in my view, but it may not be everyone, is that I suspect that the tendency of a province like this country not to exhaust its housing allocation may be as much as it's a reflection of possible deficiencies in the administrative system there. It may also be a reflection that certain people that are targeted for the grant there, in fact, don't need the grant. And part of this program, when you have got a housing program, and you want to pretend that every corner of South Africa makes this thing. Whereas if there were to be, say, a corresponding program that's targeted at aggressively supporting rural development, things like agriculture, possibly agriculture, and stuff like that, which may be something that Eastern Cape needs more, then this would work very well. And you say to Southern, you know, and Western Cape, you know, the couple of these big cities in Africa, it's not even important. Here is money to deal with the housing problem, but the other part of the country for them to feel totally capable, here is what we are giving to you, depending on your needs. But that kind of a debate, you know, sometimes gets a bit sensitive because people feel that you are putting people who come from rural areas and saying, now because I come from there, I know that my parents are very happy with their own of us, and they were there, some of them, 42 years ago when I was born, but they are still there today.
My question still remains, who's not hungry? Alright, if Mamela about the figure six, what we will do then is we will go straight for lunch and immediately adjourn. Tomorrow we shall serve up to with some of the issues in terms of the workshop. But this was a briefing as we were saying at the beginning of present. Discussing is going to ensue from now on. Now, just for your own homework, Mr. Friedman and your team, part of what you must come back to is amending of the TFMA. I think there are structures that are very much actually kind of what are no more available in the country and some other entities. I think let's just also look at that as a priority for that issue. The law is a bit current. I was just going through the TFMA that we are now worried. I think are no more in existence now. I think my grand act of that we have to do some audits in terms of the national provinces, etc. So that we just clean up the certain area in terms of one thing. Now, having then said that, can we go to the old assembly for a while? We'll have a workshop in the old assembly tomorrow, 10 o'clock. Okay? Old assembly chamber. And thank you for all your
input. Papa, I've made a very interesting analysis. You don't know the importance of this.